Phantom Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Star Wars, Showdown at Centerpoint, Volume 3 of the Corellian Trilogy by Roger McBride Allen. Either the comm circuit up to the ship's control cabin was on the verge of giving out again, or else Han had just gotten lucky and Drachmas was about to lose her voice. Han slapped the answer switch and tried to stay focused on his work. Keep your shirt on, Drachmas. Tell honored pilot Sal Guldan I'm nearly done.
What shirt? Should shirts be worn? Is this for safety?
Han sighed and pushed the answer button again. It's an expression. It means be patient. Drachmas was a Solonian, and most Solonians did not like being in space. Understandable for a species that mostly lived underground, but having an agoraphobic who wasn't even a pilot in command of a rundown cone ship was enough to drive anyone crazy. Han Solo engaged the power switch, waited for the inverter system to energize, and crossed his fingers. He was starting to question his sanity in volunteering to help fly this particular cone ship down out of free space to the surface of Solonia. He could have said, so long and good luck, and ridden down with Leia on the Jade Spire. But when a job needed doing and no one else could do it, volunteering was not really all that voluntary. He had obligations to Drachmas and to her people. And Drachmas had made it clear that her people, the Solonians, or more accurately, the Hunchuzuk Den, couldn't afford to abandon any spacecraft, no matter what shape it was in. Knowing he was with the Hunchuzuk would have been a bit more useful if Han had had some clear idea about who or what the Hunchuzuk Den was. All he knew for sure was that the Den was part of an amorphous faction of Solonians who had left their planet in the Corellian system to live on his own home planet of Corellia. And that so far as Drachmas knew, they were still allied to a pro-New Republic alliance of Solonian dens called the Republicists. Drachmas had either kidnapped Han or rescued him from Thrakken Sal Solo, Han's cousin and the leader of the thugs who called themselves the Human League, or both. Han was still not sure. The Hunchuzuk seemed to be having a fight with the Overden, the leadership on Solonia proper, a fight that was going on in parallel with the New Republic's battle against the rebellions in the Corellian system, though the two did not seem to be directly related to each other. The Overden wanted absolute independence for Solonia. Han was coming to the conclusion that each side was primarily against the other, but Drachmas had saved his life and she had taken risks to treat him well. Han knew that Thrakken Sal Solo had treated Drachmas' people with the utmost cruelty. Since relatives in Solonian society were genetically identical, Solonians were likely to assume that Han was a villain like his cousin, yet Drachmas had given him every benefit of the doubt.
When will it be working? The planet is getting closer.
Don't hold me to this, but I think the spare parts off Mara's ship did the trick. We ought to be able to get underway anytime you like. The indicators flickered to show the inverters were drawing more power. Take it easy up there. Throttle up nice and slow, all right?
We are doing so, Honored Solo. We have no desire to overload our systems again.
Han climbed up to the nose cabin of the cone ship. The cone ship was just that, a fat cone with the engines at the base and the control cabin in the point. The nose itself was nearly all transplex, affording a spectacular overhead view. The Solonia pilot, Sal Kuld, lay flat on her back, looking up and out at the sky ahead. She gave Han a toothy smile and returned her attention to her work, but the large, otter-like creature looked anything but calm. How does all go? Han asked Sal Kuld, speaking in his rather labored Solonian. Sal Kuld did not speak basic.
All is well, Honored Solo. At least until the next subsystem flips out.
Wonderful, Han muttered. Sal Gould was a fairly experienced pilot and knew her ship reasonably well, if not as well as Han would have preferred. Drachmas, on the other hand, was trained to deal with humans. When it came to ship handling, she had no experience and no skill. Even so, she commanded the ship, not just in deciding where it would go, but down to the detail of every maneuver. Sal Gould could not or would not overrule her. Drachmas was of higher status, and that was that. Neither seemed much concerned by the fact that Drachmas had only a slight understanding of space operations, or that during the battle between the New Republic and their allies against units from the various rebellions, she had repeatedly ordered the ship to do things it could not do, and had come alarmingly close to getting them all killed. The view out the transparent nose of the cone ship was nothing less than spectacular. The Salonian landmass was broken up into thousands of medium-sized islands, more or less evenly spaced across the face of the planet. But there was more to the view than the planet. Mara Jade's personal ship, the Jade Spire, hung in space a kilometer or two away, her bow hiding a bit of the planet's equatorial region. Mara's ship was long and streamlined, painted in a flame pattern of red and gold. The ship looked fast, sleek, strong, maneuverable, and Han knew she was all of those things. After Drachmas had given Sal Gould orders that had blown out nearly every system on board the cone ship, the fire had rescued them and provided Han with the spare parts he needed to repair the craft. Now the fire was preparing to see the cone ship to a safe landing. A bright light flashed on and off from the forward port of the fire. Leia was using the landing lights on the Jade's fire to send Mon Calamari blink code, combinations of long and short flashes to form the letters of the basic alphabet. Ready to begin entry, Han read. Signal when ready. Honor Drachmas, take your seat and prepare for acceleration. Sal Gould, you will apply a standard approach to the intended field of landing, starting on my command. Is that understood?
Indeed, absolutely.
As Han watched, the Jade's fire came about on her long axis, putting her stern toward the cone ship. Sal Gould edged the throttle upward, transferring minimum power to the engines. As the cone ship began to accelerate toward the planet, the fire drifted back. As the more maneuverable ship, it made sense for the fire to go in second, where she could keep watch on the cone ship. But the cone ship was all but completely blind astern. All she had was one wide-angle camera set in the base of the cone between two of the sublight engines. It would be useful during the final approach and landing, but even with the main engines off, its resolution was so poor that the Jade's fire would be lost to view if she drifted only a few kilometers away. The poor visibility made for another good reason to have the fire go in second. Better to have a ship you trusted at your back. At least a ship you more or less trusted. Han had managed to put to rest most of his reservations regarding Mara. He could think of no reason, no motive for her acting against Han and Leia and the Republic, despite her past as the Emperor's hand. But in recent days, she had been in the right places at the right times, and the wrong places at the wrong times, a bit too often. On the other hand, if she had wanted to do real damage, Mara was too much of a pro to let things be bungled. Say whatever else you might about the woman, Mara was competent. The planet moved closer. In another few minutes, Sal Gould would have to turn the ship over and point its engines forward to slow the craft. That was the part that worried Han. Once they were decelerating, they would be at their most vulnerable. The cone ship's fragility was far from the only source of danger. Someone on Salonia had sent a whole fleet of light attack fighters up to attack the Bakuran ships that were assisting the New Republic on this mission. The Bakurans had done a fair amount of damage to the LAFs, but Han had to assume that whoever commanded them would have the sense to hold some in reserve. To make matters worse, the cone ship was completely unarmed and had no shields at all. Leia Organa Solo, chief of state of the New Republic, sat at the navigator station aboard the Jade's Fire, watching a cone ship drift in toward Salonia. What exactly was Han getting them into? Leia was forced to think not just like a wife, but like a politician. There was no question that Han was being drawn in by these Salonians, and that she was being drawn in as well. It would be all too easy for the New Republic to find itself involved in one side or the other of the fight.
He'll be all right, Leia, Mara said. We'll stay right with them all the way down.
What? Oh, yes, Leia said. It was mortifying to be reassured by Mara Jade, of all people. Mara frowned and adjusted the thrust controls.
Now, that Salonian pilot needs a flying lesson or two. She's doing the pitchover maneuver way too early, and without shutting off her engines, nearly clipped her. Mara was forced to fly evasive patterns just to keep the fire from crashing into the other ship. Suddenly, she noticed something on her detector displays. Leia, weapons and shields, stand by fast. A bunch of blips just showed up out of nowhere. Leia watched as the defense trackers came on. More light attack fighters. 12 in all, coming in right over our stern. Mara shook her head as she stared down at the navigation display. We can handle them, but it won't be easy now with the cone ship to cover. We're too far off to extend our shields toward the cone ship, and we're going to stay that way. I'm not getting any closer to that pilot than I have to. Stand by for combat maneuvers. Wait! We have to blink code to Han. Warn them. You've got 25 seconds. Han was almost too busy trying to keep from being flung out of his chair to notice the flashing lights in the overhead viewport. The trouble was that he was only marginally better at reading blink code than he was at sending it. B-A-N-D-I... Something Bandai?
Bandits.
Oh, great. Bandits. Enemy fighters were headed this way. Han glanced over at the Salonians. There was no point in telling Sal Gould about the bandits until she had the ship under control. Now then, Sal Gould, one other matter is time to, test our defense plan. You will bring the ship to spin, please, of 3 spins per minute.
Yes, commencing axial spin.
The ship began to rotate around its conical axis, so the stars pinwheeled across the sky. Han could barely spot the fire, and the bandits were almost certainly smaller coming from behind. There was no way he could find them, especially with the ship spinning like a top. No point worrying about things he could not change. Disable inertial damping, he said casually. The inertial dampers prevented anything more than a few percent of a ship's acceleration from being felt by those aboard. Without them, the occupants of a ship accelerating to light speed could be squashed to jelly.
But if we cannot restart inertial damping...
Oh, Sal Gould began. Worry about such later. Han knew better than Sal Gould what it might mean if they couldn't get the dampers back on, but they would have to live long enough for the problem to come up. Sal Gould inhaled nervously and cut off the inertial damping system. All of a sudden, Han felt his weight double, then triple. Confirm all inner airlock seals.
All inner airlock doors sealed.
Han struggled to concentrate on the spinning star field overhead. If this was going to work, it would take exact timing. But how could he time anything if he couldn't see? Leia worked the shield settings on the Jade's fire. Shields configured as ordered, she said. Good, Mara replied. Maintain turbo lasers at standby. We are going to act like they aren't there. They might decide we can't see them. What good does that do us? They might blow right past us and zero in on the cone ship. My guess is that whoever's on those LAFs is targeting the Hunchuzuk, not us. But Han is... Safer this way, Mara kept watching her displays. If the LAFs don't engage us, we'll have nice, clear forward view shots right up their stern plates while they're focused on the cone ship. Leia gave in again. Mara had far more experience in this sort of fight than she did. Stand by. Here they come, Mara said. Leia watched the stern detector displays as the LAFs came in directly behind the fire's stern, trying to hide in the detection shadows produced by the sublight engines. They were trying to sneak up. From that bearing, they wouldn't even show up on most ships' detectors. The LAF flashed past the fire, zeroing in on the cone ship. Here they come! Han shouted in Basic, forgetting for a moment to speak in Salonian. Sal Gould got the message all the same. She looked up through the viewport at the tiny spots of light in the sky and understood precisely what was going on. Calmness! Throttle down all engines. Stand by to open outer airlock doors. The lead LAF fired and the bolt slammed into the hull like a giant fist. It's all right, Han shouted, having not the least idea if it was or not. Stand by on airlock doors. Be ready. The Jade's fire's forward quad turbo laser blazed away, tracking the LAF across the sky. The LAF broke off its attack run, trying to escape, but the Jade's fire regained a positive lock and poured on the turbo lasers. The fighter exploded in a blossom of flame. The rest of the LAFs were not going to be such easy pickings. They had their rear shields powered up to maximum and did a better job of evasive maneuvers.
But it wasn't good enough to fool Leia. She settled in with the manual controls and concentrated her fire on the LAFs closest to the cone ship. She got a lock on one and blew it to bits. Just then the cone ship cut its engines, allowing it to drop straight for the planet's surface. It threw the LAFs off, if only for a moment or two. Leia sighed. Not much of an evasive maneuver, but probably the best Han could manage with that clunky piece of junk. But suddenly, her detector display showed a cloud of debris blooming out from the cone ship in all directions. Fear stabbed at her heart. That one hit on the hull couldn't have done that much damage, could it? But then something happened to one of the LAFs. And then another. And another. As they swooped in close to the cone ship, they bounced and skittered and wobbled off course. Two of them lost power, and the third was rocked by a small explosion amidships. Leia tried to track to a new target, but the LAFs had plainly decided to accept the fact they weren't welcome. They scattered, hightailing out of there in all directions. Suddenly, Leia understood. Mara, new course, 5 or 6 kilometers to one side of Han, and try to overtake him. It's not going to be safe to be behind him for a while. Leia smiled, relief flooding over her. She should have known Han wouldn't give up without a fight. Han listened closely as the last of the junk went lumbering out of the airlocks, banging and clattering. He had spent half a day policing the ship, looking for every bit of surplus or broken hardware he could find. Buckets of bolts, worn-out spare parts, garbage from the galley. He had thrown all of it into the locks. And all of it had tumbled out into space when the locks were opened, thrown clear by centrifugal force. Result, a cloud of slow-moving space junk right in the path of the attacking LAFs. Plowing through pieces of broken metal at a speed of something like 1,000 kilometers an hour was very far from a good idea. However, piling a ship into a planet was an even worse one. Salkut, re-establish inertial dampers and cut ship spin. The ship's ungainly spin slowed, then stopped, and then started up again in the opposite direction and started to get faster. Salkut, this is no time for the playing of games. Han Solo, failure in lateral attitude control system. I cannot shut it off. Han scrambled up out of his seat and dove for the main circuit breaker box. He yanked it open and tripped the lateral attitude control breaker by hand. That killed the thrusters that were producing the spin, but also killed the ones that fired in the opposite direction and could bring it to a halt. He slapped the access door shut and returned to his seat. Hope everyone is liking to spin for a while. Salkut, restart to main sublight engines. And nice, slow throttle up, please. Nothing seemed to happen. Not that slow, Salkut. We need to do some braking. Salkut looked at Han, panicked.
Engine initiator, not responding. Horror,
cried Drachmus.
We incinerate for certain.
Once again, Han rushed for the ladder and clambered down to the lower decks as fast as he could. Without the sublight engines, the cone ship was going to drop like a stone. They had to restart those engines. Out! Han shouted at Salkut as he came up out of the hatch. Out of pilot chair, now! I take over.
But what are you...
I've taken the disperser out of the loop and run the cables through the initiator power intake on the engine power system. The feedback energy is accumulating in the repulsor system. When the power level is high enough, I'll reset the feedback power breaker and dump the energy right into the initiator intake on the engine power systems.
What?
Jump start it! I'm gonna jump start it! There was a moment of dead silence in the control cabin before Drachmus let out a strangled moan and covered her face with her hands. For a fleeting moment, Han thought of Leia, watching from the jade fire and unable to do anything. He thought of his 3 children off somewhere in the care of Chewbacca and the children's Drow tutor, Ibrahim. No, he could not die. They needed him. Han waited as long as he dared, then one moment longer, then one more, and then... He slammed down the relay reset switch as hard as he could and felt a horrifying lurch just as a low, rumbling explosion shook the ship. That would be the repulsors blowing. For a long, sickening moment, nothing else happened. But then the engine's initiated indicator came on and Han had 3 good engines. Even if that was 1 less than he had hoped for, it was 3 more than he'd expected. Ignoring all his own advice, he brought the throttle up fast. There wasn't time to nurse the engines. The cone ship slowly pitched back a until it was flying at about a 45-degree angle of attack. It was still falling straight down, but now its nose was pointed an eighth of a turn away from the vertical. If Han had it figured right, that ought to give the cone ship a bit of aerodynamic lift, causing it to work like an airfoil. The ship began to move sideways as well as down. It began to bang and shudder violently, but every crash and rattle was that much more excess energy expended.
Han Solo,
Zachmas protested above the racket.
Where are you taking us?
I haven't the faintest idea, but we have to go lateral to shed some speed.
But suppose we land outside the zone controlled by my den?
Then we have a problem. Zachmas did not reply to that, but she had a point. Landing completely at random on a planet in the midst of civil war was not exactly prudent. Han pushed it from his mind. The job of the moment was getting this thing down in one piece, down where they could sort out later. He checked his gauges. They were still falling like a rock, but a slower rock, a gliding rock. And hull temperatures were actually falling. Maybe they were going to make it. Han cut power to all systems and diverted it all into the inertial dampers. There was no way the dampers could absorb all the energy of impact, but they would soak up some of it. He had not the faintest idea where they were about to land. 1 kilometer up, 800 meters. How accurate was that altimeter anyway? 200, 150, zero. Negative 10 meters. Well, not all that accurate. But every extra meter was another fraction of a second for the cone ship's engines to slow them down. Neg 20. Neg 50. The overhead viewport held together somehow. And Han could see the sky was filled with smoke and steam and mud. Huge gobs of sodden dirt splattered down on the viewport, covering it all but completely. Except for Drachmas moaning in fright and the plopping sounds of mud raining down on the ship's hull, all was quiet. They were down and alive. The cone ship had buried itself into the soft mud of a pond. Han sat on the edge of the hatch and hopped down, only to sink in over his ankles in the thick mud. He lifted his left foot up out of the muck, nearly losing a boot in the process, and planted it as far away from the ship as possible before pulling his right foot out. He squelched out of the pond basin toward dry land and saw a Solonian, an older-looking female with graying dark brown fur and a moody look in her eye.
That's a Hanshazar cone ship, be it not?
The Solonian asked, watching Drachmas and Salkuld stagger out of the craft.
That's right, Han said as he slogged through the mud.
That was the Solonians for you. A spaceship crash lands in a pond in front of someone, and what's the response? Not shock, or surprise, or fear. Not hello, or what an amazing escape. Not are you all right?
No.
The first thing to worry about was what den was involved.
Huh, said the Solonian. This is Tanzari land. We be republicists, Hanshazar allies.
The Bakurin light cruiser Intruder fired her main forward turbo laser battery 3 times, and 3 pocket patrol boats exploded.
Very well, said Admiral Hortel Osinich. You may hold your fire. Bring the turbo lasers to their stowed position and power them down. Make sure our friends can detect what you're doing. We have shown we can hurt them at will. Now we extend an invitation to leave.
Luke Skywalker stood next to Admiral Osinich on the bridge of the Intruder. A reasonable tactic, Luke thought. As always, when he agreed with the man, he did not feel comfortable doing so. He glanced at Lando Calrissian standing on the other side of Osselage, and the look on his face told him that Lando shared his concerns. The tactics were sound, even conservative. The enemy forces consisted of little more than 20 or so pocket patrol boats. There was nothing much to be gained in wiping out such a small force. Very sensible and cautious. Except that Osselage was not a cautious commander. If it seemed he was trying something careful, Luke had a hunch that it was merely a cover for something madly audacious to follow. Or had losing the one of his 4 cruisers, the Watchkeeper, to the Solonian planetary repulsor cost Osselage his nerve? Of course, with the overwhelming bulk of Centerpoint Station dominating the sky outside the viewports, Luke would have felt a little edgy even if the Watchkeeper hadn't been destroyed.
There they go,
Lando announced, pointing toward a cloud of tiny dots lifting away from one of the docking bays of Centerpoint. The defending fighters were withdrawing.
Decided they couldn't do any good against us, I guess. Or perhaps they decided we would be unable to do Centerpoint any harm, said Ocelich.
A service droid wheeled up from behind them and stopped in front of Lando.
Begging your pardon, sir, but Lieutenant Kalinda wishes to see both you and Master Skywalker, sir. A new message from Source T has come in.
Source T was Tendra Rezaant. Lando and Luke had met Tendra on Sikoria, one of the so-called outlier worlds of the Corellian sector. The local authorities had kicked Lando and Luke off Sikoria shortly after they arrived. Lando had met Tendra while searching the galaxy for a rich wife. From what Lando could piece together, she had spotted some sort of military buildup in the Sikorian system. Recently, a powerful jamming system had cut off virtually all communications in the Corellian sector. Then an interdiction field had gone up, preventing travel through hyperspace anywhere in the sector. Believing these events related to the buildup, Tendra had decided to get word to Lando. She had gotten her hands on an old spaceship, bribed her way off Sikoria, and crashed into the interdiction field. Even though she couldn't get to Lando in person, he had made it possible for her to contact him. The signals from the radionics communications set he had given her were immune to jamming and undetectable to anyone using standard comlink equipment. It took long hours for her messages to reach him, but it could take long, weary months before her ship could cross the same distance. Unless, of course, they could bring down the interdiction field, and that was why they were heading toward Center Point Station, where the jamming seemed to originate. The security system beeped its clearance code, and the hatch to the comm section slid open. Lieutenant Valindi Kalenda of New Republic Intelligence was waiting for them. An odd-looking young woman. Right now, her wide-spaced, slightly off-kilter eyes did not look happy. "Didn't anyone ever tell your lady friend how to count?" she said. "We still have no idea how many ships are waiting out there at Sikoria."
"We wouldn't have known there were any ships at all there if not for Lady Tendra," Lando said sharply.
"Let's try and get back on track here," Luke said. "What's wrong with Lady Tendra's message?"
"We have sent 3 queries asking her to give further details of the types, sizes, and numbers of ships she saw. Her latest message seems more precise, but once you weed out all the qualifiers, we still have nothing but the vaguest estimates."
"Well, she can't tell you what she doesn't know," Lando said.
"There are also limits to how many messages you can ask her to send," Luke put in. "Every time she sends us one, the odds of her being detected go up." Kalinda looked at Luke sharply.
"Detected? How?"
"Think about it," Lando said. "You're the intelligence officer. The way she's broadcasting is secret, but it's in clear without any coding or encryption. Anyone who has the right sort of gear for scanning radio band frequencies could lock in on her radionics transmission in a heartbeat."
Kalinda nodded reluctantly.
"Let's leave it there," Lando said. "We're coming up on Centerpoint Station. Figuring that out ought to be enough to keep us busy."
The Lady Luck launched out of the intruder's landing bay and lifted off into the blackness of the sky toward Centerpoint. Lieutenant Kalenda and Bakuran ex-Prime Minister Gariel Katsison rode with Lando, as did C-3PO.
"Why do I always get handed these jobs?" Lando asked no one in particular.
"Maybe it has something to do with the way you volunteered," replied Gariel Katsison from the seat behind the co-pilot station.
"I had to volunteer. Once Luke volunteered, I knew he was going to need his wingman."
"Actually, Lady Katsison," said Kalenda, "you're the one I most wish weren't here."
"Thanks for that compliment," Lando muttered.
Kalenda winced. "Sorry, that came out wrong. What I meant was that Captain Calrissian and Master Skywalker have military training. They're more likely to be ready for whatever we find. Not really the job for an ex-Prime Minister."
"There might be someone reasonable with whom we can negotiate on Centerpoint Station. If so, having a trained negotiator such as myself on hand might be a good thing," said Gariel.
"We're going to have to get really lucky for that to happen," Lando said. "So far, we haven't found many people who are particularly reasonable in this star system." Luke Skywalker felt good. He was back at the controls of his X-Wing, alone, except for R2-D2 up in his socket.
He looked toward the massive station and could scarcely believe his eyes. He had seen the reports, he had read the numbers, but somehow, numbers did not express the size of the object hanging in the sky. Center Point Station consisted of a huge sphere 100 kilometers across, with a massive cylinder stuck to each pole of the sphere. The station rotated slowly around the axis defined by the two polar systems. Boxy things, the size of large buildings, pipes and tubes of all sizes, and strange patterns of conical shapes sprouted everywhere. Luke had been on worlds smaller than this station. Apart from the question of size, the station was disconcerting because it spun. Spinning was something that planets did, but you could see Center Point moving. Something else, more fundamental than size or spin, was bothering Luke. The station was so old that no one knew how long ago it had been built, or who had built it, or why.
Luke, if you're there.
I'm here, Lando, but your signal is breaking up badly. With normal communications still jammed, the Bakurans had done their best to improvise a laser comm system that sent voice signals over low-power laser beams. It did not work well, but it did work. R2, see if you can clean that up a little. Luke nodded. Okay, Lando, try it again. How do you read me?
Much better. Yolanda spotted something. Look at the base of the closest cylinder. Right where it joins the sphere, there's a blinking light. Here, see it?
Luke activated the targeting computer to get a lock on the blinking light. There it was, next to a large outer airlock door that was opening and shutting over and over again. If that's not an invitation to come on in, I don't know what is. Anakin Solo stared at the featureless silver wall, and then thumped twice at one particular spot on it. Sure enough, an access door popped open, revealing a purple and green control keypad with a grid of keys. The 7-year-old frowned at the keypad, as if trying to decide his next move. The droid Q9X2 watched carefully. Q9 found Anakin's skill with machinery, his seemingly instinctive ability to make devices work even when he had no idea what the devices were, to be remarkably disconcerting. It seemed to have something to do with this force business that was so important to this group of humans. The theory seemed to be that Anakin's talent in the force had given him the ability to see inside machines. Not that the little boy was infallible by any means. Anakin punched a code into the access panel. Experience had taught Q9 that this sound was not a good sign. It seemed to be a sort of warning bell.
That will do, Anakin.
And I've almost got it working.
Do you have any idea what it does?
No,
Anakin admitted.
Do you remember what happened the last time you heard that chime and you kept going?
A trap door opened.
Yes, a trap door opened under me, and I fell into a waste disposal chute.
Oh, maybe I better stop and let Chewie look.
Maybe you'd better. Come on. Let's go find the others.
They were a motley crew, all of them holed up inside the underground repulsor chamber on the planet Drawl. The place was shielded from every detection system that Q9 knew about, with the exception of Anakin Solo. Anakin had found this chamber and its identical twin on Corellia with no trouble whatsoever. And there were good reasons for hiding the chamber. It contained the planetary repulsor that had propelled Drawl into its current orbit unknown millennia ago. Likewise with Corellia, and no doubt with the other inhabited worlds of the Corellian sector, Celonia and the double worlds Talus and Trollus. Each of them had a hidden chamber like this one. The party in the repulsor chamber had been cut off from outside contact for some time, but the last information they had was that rebel forces on at least some and probably all of the inhabited worlds were actively searching for the repulsors, possibly so they could use them as weapons. The chamber itself was a huge vertical cone made of gleaming metallic silver. At the base of the chamber was a circle of 6 smaller cones of the same silver material. In the exact center of the base was a 7th, larger cone, twice as tall as the others, but with the same slender proportions. Passages to side chambers were spaced around the circumference of the chamber, and vertical shafts in the floor led to a series of lower levels they hadn't even started to explore. It was a huge, artificial, alien place. And a ramshackle, homey-looking campsite was sitting right in the middle of it, by the base of the central cone. The Millennium Falcon was also in the chamber, the hover car belonging to the Solo children's Drolin tutor Ebrahim, and his aunt, the Duchess Marcia of Mastagophorus, was parked alongside it. A line with washing on it was strung between the Falcon's topside parabolic antenna and a spike antenna on the roof of the hover car. Q-9 could see the rest of the party from here. The twins, Jason and Jaina, carrying some sort of gear out of the Millennium Falcon, Chewbacca fiddling with hardware, and the two plump, furry drawl at a table hunched over their own work. The drawl were serious, level-headed beings in general. Even if Ebrahim was a bit flighty by drawlish standards, his aunt was one of the most commonsensical beings Q-9 had ever met. No doubt Anakin's latest discovery would give them something else to work on, another piece to the puzzle they were struggling to put together. It was well into the night before Ebrahim finally said to the Duchess,
"Come, dearest aunt, it is late.
Everyone else is asleep.
Whatever progress we have made is only the barest start toward understanding this place,"
the Duchess replied.
"We have some idea of how the keypads are laid out and what some of the button markings and color codings seem to mean. But going from there to operating this place and shutting it down safely, a machine that has been operating for at least tens of thousands of years, we have no idea how it draws its power. Suppose we do learn how to turn it off. Where does the power go once it is not coming here? I think it most probable that this chamber is but one part of a much larger system. We are dealing with a device that can move a planet. Used improperly, a device of that power could also destroy a planet. I do not see any way of learning all we need to know in any reasonable period of time. Unless, of course, we simply instruct Anakin to find the main control panel and then set him loose on it."
March's eyes widened in horror.
"Do not say such a thing, nephew. Not even in jest. Jokes like that have a way of coming true."
Anakin's eyes snapped open. He was wide awake and staring up at the underhull of the Millennium Falcon. He sat up quietly and looked around. Everyone was asleep. That left Q-9. Anakin knew that the bulk of the Falcon would block nearly all of the droid's sensors. So long as he kept the ship between himself and Q-9, he ought to be able to sneak away. He moved unerringly through the complicated maze of passages, taking every turn with absolute confidence. And there it was, just as he had left it, the initial keypad open and waiting. He closed his eyes, reached out, and felt the interior of the pad, tracing the circuits, the logic paths, the potentials and safeties that were inside the machine. It had been asleep for so long, waiting for someone to wake it up. Anakin pressed the center button of the grid. The green button turned purple. Good. Slowly he felt each button, pushed them in what he knew was the right order. A section of the floor was sliding away. Then a complicated console rose slowly up out of the floor, all in the same silver stuff as the chamber itself. In front of it was a little seat that looked as if it were intended for a being that bent in different places than a human. Hopping with excitement, Anakin sat down in the odd little chair and did not even notice that it was adapting itself to his body, lifting him up and moving him forward so he would be able to reach the controls more comfortably. He shut his eyes and reached out into the intricate universe of the control panel. Anakin put his hands on the control panel and felt it all flow through him. Somewhere deep below, the ground shuddered slightly, and the hum began to build, accompanied by the noise he heard before. A flat spot on the control panel swirled upward to form a handle like a spacecraft's joystick. Anakin reached out to it as the handle reshaped itself to fit his hand. A graphic display appeared in the air over the handle, a hollow wireframe cube made up of a grid of smaller cubes. Slowly, carefully, he pulled back on the joystick. The cubes began changing color, green to purple to glowing orange. Anakin let go of the joystick. The moment he did, the chiming stopped. The joystick flattened itself back down into the control panel. And there, in the blank space at the center of the panel, a new button appeared. He held his hand poised over the button for a moment. It called to him, or else his own compulsion to make machines work called from deep inside himself. He did not know. He did not care. He reached out his left hand. He held it over the button for a moment. And then he pushed it down. Lightning flared out from the apex of the central cone in the great chamber, lancing out toward each of the lower cones, slamming into them with spark and fire. Thunder, the sound of the earth cracking open, roared out through the great chamber. The lesser cones answered back, sending their own thunderbolts to strike at the top of the center cone, blasting it into incandescence. Chewbacca, aboard the Falcon, was thrown from his bunk as the ship bounced and lurched along with the chamber. He was halfway to the ship's control room before he came fully awake and realized that the ship was not in flight, but where it had been on the ground. He rushed down the ramp and shouted at the Drow, sleeping in the hover car, to get aboard the Falcon. He saw Q-9 slump next to his charging stand, completely motionless. He scooped the droid up and headed for the Falcon. At that moment, the lightning struck again, blasting out from the central cone to the six smaller cones. The Falcon bounced on its landing jacks, riding their shock absorbers. The two Drow, the droid, the twins were all on board. Chewbacca suddenly realized that Anakin wasn't on the ship. He turned and headed toward the door. "Anakin's safe!" Jason shouted over the din, clearly seeing Chewbacca's concern. "He's in some side tunnel. I can feel him through the force. He's not hurt, and he's more scared we'll be mad at him than scared he'll get hurt. I think he set this off." Chewbacca rushed for the cockpit and activated the Falcon's shields at full strength. The Falcon rose up off her landing jacks to rest on a cushion of softened lower side shields. The bucking and heaving of the deck was still felt, but the shields smoothed it down. Another spectacular cycle of lightning bursts flashed between the cones, and then another, and another, each growing faster and more powerful. Suddenly, the entire ship was bathed in a firestorm of sparks and flares that coursed around the shields, then swooped up the sides of the conical wall toward the apex of the chamber. Chewbacca began to realize what was happening. The chamber of the planetary repulsor was opening out its apex point to get a clear shot of the sky. There had been a whole series of underground tunnels leading to the hidden entrance to this place. Surely, all of them had collapsed. Along with the Drawlist building that sat atop them, the Drawlists had been searching for the planetary repulsor. By now, the planetary repulsor had found and destroyed them. Jason came into the cockpit. "They're all okay back there," he said. "Except Q-9. He's still dead. Or off, anyway." Chewbacca nodded. They were lucky any of them were alive. If Q-9 could be repaired, he would attend to it later. If not, well, one casualty seemed a very low price for riding out this storm. Another pulse of energy swept over the Falcon. A bit rougher rise than the last one. That was a reminder, Chewie thought. A reminder that they weren't close enough to the end of this to talk about living through it. Thrakken Sal Solo, self-proclaimed diktat of the Corellian sector, leader of the Human League, stared at the bottle in front of him and gave serious thought to the idea of getting good and drunk. There seemed precious little else he could do besides wait. Thrakken had never been much good at waiting, which was ironic, for he had spent much of his adult life waiting for a superior to resign or retire or be arrested, waiting for a plot to mature, waiting for the long-awaited offer of succession from Dupas Tomri, diktat of Corellia. Waiting until the day Tomri died. Waiting for sweet victories that had melted away into bitter, humiliating defeat. Thrakken grabbed the bottle by the neck, and went out into the corridor of the archaeological dig headquarters. He would have preferred to keep his headquarters in the underground bunker on the far side of the city, but the Human League had been forced to abandon that location. The blasted Salonians had yanked their compatriot Drachmas out of there, along with Thraken's traitor cousin, Han Solo. It hadn't taken much imagination to realize that a group that could take two prisoners out of an underground bunker could just as easily put one bomb in. Call it another debt on the account Thraken was drawing up against Han Solo. Outside, Thraken watched the second shift men coming on duty, headed for their work underground. They were still searching for the Corellian planetary repulsor. It had to be hidden in the tunnel somewhere beneath them. It had to be, or things were going to get very sticky indeed. Except things were already sticky. Solo had escaped. Leia Organa Solo had escaped. The Bakurans had busted through the interdiction field somehow. Thraken knew just how dangerous a game he was playing. He had claimed to control the Starbuster plot, the power that had already exploded two star systems, one of them populated. For the moment, at least, it suited the purposes of the Starbuster's real masters to let him go on claiming it. They believed Thraken would keep to his side of the bargain and back off his claim when the moment came for them to reveal themselves. They also believed that Thraken would turn over the planetary repulsor on this world as soon as he found it in return for getting a free hand on Corellia. Thraken had other plans. The masters of the Starbuster had told all the rebel leaders that the planetary repulsors were superb defensive weapons, nothing more. Thraken knew better.
Diktat Sal Solo. Diktat.
Thraken turned around to see General Bryman Yorar, the man in charge of the dig, jogging toward him.
News, sir. Maybe big news. The Drawl planetary repulsor just came alive.
What?
Just now, sir. The jamming is still in place, of course, so we can't get any more information. But our sensors just picked up a huge jolt of repulsor activity coming from Drawl. Unfocused, uncontrolled, but it's there.
I don't believe it. I can't believe it.
The Salonians, maybe they're good at underground work. The Overden has some good technicians, but the Drawlists, they were never anything. In moments of honesty, Thraken knew his own Human League forces were not exactly the cream of society. Thugs, most of them. Even with all the help he got from the Starbuster's masters, he had not been able to recruit many high-quality people. He had learned to accept that and view his troops as the best tools he could lay his hands on, if not the best tools for the job. But thugs or not, compared to the Drawlists, the Human Leaguers were perfect gentlemen and leading scientists, every one of them. Thraken had at least been able to buy himself a few disgruntled technicians, some ex-Imperial soldiers and administrators, not the Drawlists. Whatever else you could say against the Drawlish species, the pompous little fools were, for the most part, relentlessly honest, upright, cautious people. There had actually been some sort of discontent on Corellia, and probably on Salonia and Talus and Trollis, around which to build a revolt. On Drawl, the rebellion had been, out of necessity, completely artificial. Even the Human League wouldn't have taken on humans as low down as the Drawlists. And Drawlist technical capability was no better than Drawlist behavior. Wait a minute, Thraken thought. Wait just a moment. Maybe the Drawlists hadn't gotten it running. Maybe someone else had managed that little trick. Suddenly, he had a shrewd idea who that might be. He turned toward Yorar. Get the best of the repulsive tech crews together along with a strike platoon. He lifted the bottle to his lips and took a big swallow.
We're going to pay a little call on the Drawlists.
Luke watched the blinking light over the huge airlock chamber and wondered who was on the other side asking them in. He shut his eyes and reached out, probing with his force ability, searching for the feel of the station of the beings aboard it. He could detect exactly one sentient mind, a human one, a young woman. That mind seemed worried and afraid, but friendly enough for all of that. The deck of the airlock was littered with debris, bits of clothing, broken pieces of luggage, freight containers, abandoned machinery, even a small spacecraft with all its access ports opened and its nose assembly removed. Obviously, it had been cannibalized for parts. The comm was activated.
Looks like some folks got out of here in a hurry.
Looks like, Luke answered Lando. But what exactly had they been in such a hurry to get away from? Luke made a nice, smooth landing, and the Lady Luck eased down on her repulsors in front of the X-Wing. The moment she landed, there was a shimmering in the space over their heads. Then the activated force field settled down into a thin blue haze that surrounded the two ships. Luke understood that by using a force field system, the station's controllers could avoid constantly pressurizing and depressurizing the chamber. No small issue with one this size. A tunnel, formed of the same blue haze, came into being just behind the Lady Luck. Luke could see that it led to a more conventional-sized inner airlock hatch. The incoming air whipped up some of the debris until the inside of the force field bubble was swirling with bits of paper and dust and torn-up packing material. The X-Wing rocked back on its shock absorbers as the air pushed at it. Luke watched his exterior gauges as the roaring subsided. At least as far as his instruments were concerned, it was perfectly normal air at perfectly normal pressure. He popped the canopy of the X-Wing and dropped lightly to the ground. As the others emerged from the Lady Luck, Luke heard a beeping from the topside of his X-Wing. Don't worry, R2, I haven't forgotten you. He reached out with the force and lifted R2 into the air and was just about to bring him down to the deck when the hatch at the end of the force field tunnel began to lumber open. Everyone turned to look. A tall, thin, pale-skinned woman with prominent eyebrows came in. She hesitated at the entrance for a moment, and then shrugged and walked toward them at a brisk clip. "How are you doing that?" she asked. "And why?" "Huh?" Luke asked and looked up. "Oh!" He had nearly forgotten that R2 was still hanging in midair. If he had lost any more concentration, R2 would have crashed to the deck. He landed him gently. "It's sort of a long story," Luke said. "I'll bet," the young woman said, giving Luke a quizzical look. "Well, anyway, I'm Jenica Sonson, C-Point C-00 Ad-Op." "What?" Luke asked. Sonson sighed. "Sorry, force of habit. Center Point Chief Operations Officer, Administration and Operations. Basically, I run the place these days. The C-Point CE declared a bug out right after the first major flare incident, and the whole exec-sec evac'd along with practically all the C-Point CivPop. I wish I could get out of here, but I was OOD when the bug was called, so Reg said I was stay behind." Luke was about to ask her what that meant when 3PO stepped forward.
Perhaps I might be of help, Master Skywalker. I believe that what Administrative Officer Sonson means is that Centerpoint's chief executive ordered a full evacuation after the first flare disaster, and the entire executive secretariat left along with most of the civilian populace. Although she wished to leave with everyone else, Administrative Officer Sonson happened to be the officer on duty at the moment when the evacuation was declared, and under those circumstances, she was automatically designated the officer to stay behind and serve as a caretaker.
She didn't say anything about a disaster, Lando said suspiciously.
I beg your pardon, but she did refer to a major incident. That is a common bureaucratic euphemism for catastrophe.
Hold it! The tin box got it all correct, but I am right here. You could ask me what I meant. Only if you promise to speak basic like everyone else, Lando said. For a moment it looked as if Sonson were about to bite Lando's head off, but she backed down.
Oh, maybe you've got a point. But I have to know what you're doing here. Your ships blew out of nowhere, and then those fighters bugged out, too.
Were they your fighters? Kalinda asked. And what government do you represent?
The fighters you were shooting at?
Now, they weren't Fed-Dub.
Fed-Dub?
Sorry. The Federation of the Double Worlds.
Kalinda nodded. The Federation is the duly elected government of Talos and Phallus.
You people still haven't told me who you are and what you're doing here.
Our apologies, Gariel said, speaking for the first time. She introduced them all. We are taking possession of Centerpoint Station in the name of the New Republic.
Well, good. It's about time somebody did. Come this way, and I'll show you where everything is. She turned around abruptly and started walking down the tunnel. On the opposite side of the lock chamber, they entered a waiting turbobeta car. We might as well start out with Hollow Town. It's what everyone always wants to see first.
Hollow Town?
Lando asked. There was a second's pause. You're not all that well briefed, are you? Hollow Town is the open space in the exact center of the sphere. Where you docked was just about at the join between the North Pole, that's what the locals call the cylinders, the North and South Poles, and the central sphere. We're now moving parallel to the axis of rotation, sideways, in toward Hollow Town. We have to pass through about 20 kilometers of decks and shells first. A shell is what we call a real high-ceiling deck, anything over about 20 meters or so. There are about 2,000 levels, all told.
What were the flares you mentioned? Luke asked.
You people don't know about the flares?
First we've heard of them. We just broke through the interdiction field into the system a few days ago.
Sonson let out a low whistle.
Broke through the interdiction field? That's something, all right. I'll bet whoever's creating that field isn't real happy with you just now.
Kalinda frowned. Hold it. Center Point Station is generating the interdiction field, and the communications jamming, for that matter. You didn't know that?
Nope. None of us here did.
Looks like my briefing wasn't so good either.
What you've got to understand about this place is that no one understands it, Sonson went on. We just live here. We didn't know why Center Point did most of the things it did, but we knew what most of them were, or at least we thought we knew, up until the terrorists started showing us a few tricks.
Oh, we just got here, Lando said. What terrorists?
Sonson shrugged her shoulders. No group has claimed responsibility. We have suspects, the Trata Livers, the Two Worlders, and so on, but they all denied having anything to do with it.
Luke guessed that the Trata Livers meant the Trollis and Talis Liberation Party or some such. Two Worlders probably meant some crowd that wanted separate governments for each planet.
Tell us about the attacks.
Sonson went to the turbobeta car's viewport.
You'll be able to see for yourself in a minute or two. Hollow Town used to be quite a place. It grew enough food for the whole station. It had parks and nice homes and lakes and streams. Then someone started messing with the glow point.
The glow point being a sort of artificial sun, Luke asked.
That's right. And someone made it go crazy.
Who normally controls the glow point?
Lando asked.
How does it work?
One theory is that it draws its power directly from the gravitational interflux between Talis and Trollis, but no one has been able to come up with an instrument to test the idea.
A spot of light began to gleam through the end of the tunnel up ahead.
That's the glow point. It's back to normal, at least for the moment.
The humans in the group shielded their eyes against the sudden brightness.
The glow point was just that, a glowing point of light suspended in midair in the precise center of the huge spherical chamber that was Hollow Town. It looked like a miniature sun, warm, comfortable, inviting. But there was nothing comfortable about the landscape below.
Hollow Town had been charred to a land of ashes. Luke could see the skeletal remains of burned-out buildings, what had once been neatly planted orchards that were now nothing but rows of incinerated tree stumps. A lake had boiled dry. Normally, I'd stop the car at one of the intermediate stops and let you get out and look around, but there's just about no free oxygen left in there. All of it got consumed in the first flare, 30 or 40 days ago.
Kalinda objected. That was before the jamming started. I came into the system about that time, and I never heard anything about this. It should have been big news.
Now, we tried to keep it as quiet as we could. The Fed-dub government was weak enough as it was.
And what terrorists want most is publicity. The Feds were afraid that if this got out, it could spark a panic or even a rebellion here.
And I guess they were right.
We could have kept news of this from getting to the other worlds, but the refugees all had to go to Talis and Trollis.
The word spread, and we got our rebellions, all right. One on Talis, two on Trollis. One group, I don't know which, landed a bunch of fighters somewhere on the South Pole a while back, claimed the station for themselves. What was I going to do, fight them off by myself? I left them alone, and they did the same to me.
Until you chased them off.
What do you mean, by yourself? Gabriel asked. Are you the only one still on the station?
Sonson shook her head. Probably not. It's a big place. I haven't seen anybody, but that doesn't mean anything.
You referred to the first flare, Thando asked. How many were there?
Two, in all. The second happened just about a day or so before the interdiction field and the communications jamming came on.
Lando said a bit distractedly,
This station is exactly at the center point, the barycenter between Talus and Trollus, right?
Right.
And the glow point is at the exact center of Hollowtown? And Hollowtown is at the exact center of the station?
It might be off by a centimeter or two. Feel free to get a measuring stick.
Lando ignored Sonson's sarcasm. He pointed out across the huge spherical space toward the far side of the rotation axis and then tilted his head back to look through the overhead viewport.
Those conical structures coming up out of the north and south poles right on the rotation axis, what can you tell me about them?
The two clusters of cones seem to be identical, a larger central cone surrounded by six smaller cones.
Sonson shrugged.
I can tell you that one set is called the South Conical Mountains, and the other is called the North Conicals. People try to climb them once in a while, but even in the near-zero gravity zone at the spin axis, it isn't easy.
Just at that moment, R2's view lens swiveled up to take in an overhead view, and then he turned to 3PO.
Very well, R2, I will inquire, though it is very rude of you to interrupt.
3PO turned toward Jenica Sonson.
Pardon the intrusion, Administrator Sonson, but my counterpart wishes to know rather urgently if the two previous glowpoint flare events started suddenly, or if there was a gradual increase in the light source's brightness.
Interesting droids you've got. As best we're able to tell, the brightness came up gradually over the course of about half an hour.
R2 rocked back and forth on his roller legs, his head whirling.
Oh, dear, I quite agree. Captain Calrissian, the visible light output from the glow point has increased 6% in the last 5 minutes.
The Duchess Marcia of Master Gofferus sat in the lounge of the Millennium Falcon feeling downright gloomy. Her nephew, Ebrahim, was playing a dispirited game of sabacc with Jaina. The fact that Jaina had lost several hands showed just how low her spirits were. Q-9, or what was left of him, was propped up against the far bulkhead of the compartment. Jason had gone to meet Anakin, who he said was on his way back to the camp and feeling very bad. It was a miracle that none of them had been killed. Well, maybe Q-9 had been killed. At least Chewbacca had not been able to revive him. They were trapped here, and most of their rations had been outside the Falcon when the explosion occurred. Marcia's best guess, which she had not shared with anyone, was that they had enough water and food for 6 days at most. Their one hope was that Chewbacca could get the Falcon's propulsion systems working again. The Wookiee was working on the problem now, rooting around in all the access panels, knee-deep in cables and burned-out parts. It seemed that the initial burst of repulsor power had knocked them out. In all likelihood, a similar electronic pulse had blown out Q-9. Marcia heard the sound of footsteps coming up the Falcon's entry ramp and looked up to see Jason and Anakin come into the lounge. Ebrahim and Jaina looked up as well, and Chewbacca, too, appeared in the door.
Hi, everyone,
Anakin said.
I'm back. I didn't mean to hurt anything. I'm sorry.
A miracle of understatement, that.
It'll be all right, Anakin,
Jaina said.
We'll find a way to fix it all, don't you worry.
Marcia exchanged a glance with her nephew and then with the Wookiee. Clearly none of them was in the mood for empty platitudes, but sometimes platitudes were all one had left.
Of course it will be all right,
she heard herself saying as she stood up and moved toward the boy.
Come here, Anakin.
Suddenly the child burst into tears, rushed over to her, and flung his arms around her.
There, there,
she said, putting her arms around him.
There, there.
I suppose I won't like the answer if I ask you if this thing can go any faster, said Lando.
The turbovator car continued its
stately descent down to the equator line of Hollowtown and the nearest way out. The glow point had started brightening when they were at the midpoint of their descent. Jenica Sonson shook her head. No, you wouldn't like the answer.
How long until we're out of here? Kalenda asked.
Another 5 minutes or so, but there's a flaw.
What flaw?
Lando asked. There's a pressure differential between the equatorial region of Hollowtown and Shell 1, the area on the other side of the lock. The main turbovator airlock jammed up during the second flare. I managed to get it working again, but it wasn't easy. And I'm not so sure my repair is going to hold up.
So we're stuck.
We're not stuck. There's a personnel lock right next to the turbovator airlock. It's smaller and simpler, and it got a lot more use, so it's a real heavy-duty job. If we can't get the turbovator lock running, we'll have to make a run for the personnel lock. But you did happen to mention there's no oxygen left out there, Luke said. Well, even if there were any oxygen left, it would probably kill you to breathe in. Very high CO2 levels, plus all sorts of toxic burn products.
Can we all make it into the lock at once? Luke asked.
Well, the lock is big enough, but I don't think we should try all at once. I'll have to open the turbovator door by hand, run for the lock, and get it open. We should do it in two passes.
If you have to run for the other airlock, Lando said, I'll go with you. I used to run a place called Cloud City. I had to go in and out of a toxic atmosphere a lot.
Lando, if anyone should go with her, it should be me, Luke said.
No, your Jedi powers give you the best endurance. We might all need your help.
The wind began to howl as the car moved lower and lower into nightmare dust storms. The glow point was heating the lower, thicker layers of air at a different rate than the upper layers. In a spinning inside-out world, hot and cold air at different pressures was a recipe for serious weather. A wall of gritty dust enveloped the car, cutting off the view. The car slowed until it was barely moving. The swirling clouds cleared for a moment and revealed a large two-story building directly ahead.
Not the main entrance complex for this sector, said Sonson. The turbovator's track led to a large set of pressure doors.
So, let's see what happens. I'll let the automatics try it first.
The car eased to a halt in front of the doors, which started to move apart smoothly enough, but then jammed up when they were only about a meter apart.
All right, then, said Lando. Looks like we get out and walk. Time to do a little preparation.
He pulled his blouse off, pulled out his vibroshiv, and started slicing the blouse into ribbons. He stuffed one larger wad of cloth in his pocket and passed the others around.
Wrap one of these around your mouth and nose. If you pass out or your breathing reflex gets the better of you, a little cloth might filter out the worst of it.
Let's hope the personnel airlock opens so fast that you've lost your shirt for nothing, Sonson said.
Lando grinned. It breaks my heart to mess up my wardrobe when I don't need to, but I think I could deal with it just this once. Where's the other airlock?
It's about 10 meters to the left of the main airlock. It should be matched to pressure on the other side, but it shouldn't take long at all to match. Sonson looked up at the ceiling of the car where the air tanks were hanging. Match pressure. Wait a second, I just got an idea. If we dump the air from those tanks into the car here, we could get air pressure higher than the outside. Then when we open the door, our air would push out instead of the bad air pushing in.
And we'd have a pressure curtain. Good idea. Then the second group could close the doors after we go and maybe still have some air to breathe.
Lando boosted Sonson up, and she reached for the pressure regulator,
then cranked it up as high as it would go.
The air started flowing almost at once. Lando and I will get out as fast as we can and run to the other lock.
Give us 3 minutes, no more, no less, and then pop the door again and come running.
Got it, Luke said.
Okay, Lando said. Tie your gloves on.
He looked out the viewport at the swirling clouds of murky ash and soot and shook his head.
All right, R2, you time it. The rest of you, come after us in 3 minutes. Let's do it.
Sonson tied her own cloth over her mouth and nose, then hit the door open button.
The air blew out of the turbovator car with terrifying speed, and then a blast furnace of air rushed in, pulling a stream of noxious dust and smoke and soot with it. Sonson dove through the door, and Lando followed her.
Once they made it to the airlock, Sonson tried to work the old-fashioned looking controls, but the metal buttons and knobs were already too hot to touch. Lando handed her another piece of cloth. Sonson wrapped it around her hand and threw back the spill lever, equalizing pressure between the interior and exterior of the lock. The door slid open. The dust and smoke swirled around in the wretched air as Lando stumbled into the oven-hot interior of the lock and suddenly realized that Jenica was not with him. He turned to find her slumped over by the lock entrance, face down on the ground, coughing and retching. Half blinded by the caustic chemicals burning his eyes, Lando hauled Jenica into the lock. He was about to let her slump down onto the deck when he realized just how hot it had to be by now. He threw her left arm over his shoulder and held her up as he searched frantically for the inside lock controls. Still coughing, she pointed an unsteady finger to one corner of the lock. He dragged himself over, Jenica still draped over him, and pulled the closed lock lever, burning his hand in the process. He had his finger jammed down on the air pump button almost before the door latches had closed, but the automatics cut in at once anyway, not pumping in good air, but dumping the bad stuff out into the other side of the lock. Lando's lungs were screaming for air. He felt as if he were about to pass out, but he knew he did not dare. If he fainted, his reflexes would start him breathing again, and that would probably kill him. The pressure equalized, and the far lock door opened. The hot, bad air expanded out into Shell One, and good, cool air swept into the lock chamber. They could not breathe easily just yet, not until the dust and smoke dispersed, but at least they could breathe. Jenica went to the Shell One side control panel and pulled the old-fashioned lever to swing the interior door shut. Hold it! Lando had spotted a rack of emergency equipment by the door, including two small oxygen tanks with breathing masks. He grabbed one, twisted the valve to start the oxygen flowing, and threw it into the lock. Maybe there was just enough oxygen to blow around and do some good. Luke Skywalker watched R2 intently, waiting for the 3 minutes to be up. The temperature in the car had jumped dramatically when the outside air had come in. All of them were sweating profusely, and all of them, even the Jedi Master himself, were having trouble breathing. About another 30 seconds. Kalenda? Gariel, are you ready? No, not really, said Gariel, coughing, but I doubt I ever will be. Let's go, she said. Kalenda nodded. Here we go. Luke hit the button. A new blast of burning hot air struck at them as the door opened. Luke got one fleeting moment of good visibility before the roaring wall of dust and cinders enveloped them. One moment when he saw where the airlock hatch was and saw that it was swinging open for them. He reached out with the Force and found Kalenda and Gariel just a meter or two ahead of him. They were headed in the wrong direction. Luke lunged forward, guiding himself with the Force, and grabbed Kalenda by the hand and yanked hard in the proper direction. He could feel Gariel hesitate a moment, then follow. He still did not dare open his eyes, but he knew they were at the entrance to the lock. He pushed Kalenda and Gariel in before stepping in himself and running smack into something metal and tall. It was 3PO.
It would seem R2 and I got here before you, Master Luke.
There was a sudden flare of orange behind Luke. Gariel's long, flowing white dress was on fire, and she did not know it. Luke lunged for her and threw his body on the flames, trying to smother them. His flight suit was insulated and fireproof. He felt a brief bloom of heat on his chest, and that was all. He stood back up and helped Gariel to her feet. A red-hot bit of debris must have gotten lodged in the fabric of Gariel's dress, but how could it burn with no available oxygen? Luke heard a hissing noise from behind him and looked around. An oxygen mask. Lando and Kalenda had thrown an oxygen mask into the lock chamber. And Gariel had been standing right on top of it. Her dress must have trapped the oxygen. 1,000,000 to 1 shot, but one that had almost killed her. All of that flashed through his mind even as he was grabbing for the mask. He tore the cloth strip off her mouth and put the oxy mask over her mouth and nose. Still half-blinded and probably still unaware of why Luke had knocked her over, she jerked away from the mask at first until she realized what it was. Then she grabbed for it greedily and took in a deep, urgent breath. Luke handed the mask to Kalenda, who took 2 deep breaths herself before handing it back to Luke. Luke exhaled the last breath he had breathed back in the turbovator car and sucked in as much as the mask had to give.
I was on fire?
Gariel asked, looking down at the remains of her dress. Jenica had led them all to a small infirmary near the Shell One side of the airlock. Everyone had cuts and bruises and minor burns. They all needed baths and clean clothes as well, but those could wait. I apologize for throwing that oxy mask in there, said Lando.
Don't apologize, Gariel said. The mask probably saved all our lives. I was near passing out.
Jenica Sonson seemed bemused. This was no terrorist attack. To set off flares twice didn't make a great deal of sense, but
three times?
I think you're wrong there, Lando said. But I'm afraid your people here weren't the intended victims.
What do you mean?
Luke asked. Center point is right in the middle of it all. Think about it. There are three big inexplicable technologies at the middle of this crisis. The first and the easiest to explain is the system-wide jamming. And where does the jamming come from?
Center point, Jenica said, without FedDub even knowing about it, and we ran the place.
Or at least you thought you did. Second is the interdiction field. Where does it come from?
Center point. And the third unexplained technology? Luke asked.
The Nova Maker. Of course. The Starbuster. We all wondered where the Starbuster was. I'm just about positive we're sitting in it right now. I think the glow point flare means it's about to go off again.
It was a lovely morning. The star Corel was rising in the east. The rolling hills and clean blue sky of Salonia were laid out before them. The Hunchuzuk Den had installed Han, Aunt Leia and Mara when they joined him, in a splendid hilltop villa, clearly built for the use of visiting human dignitaries.
I am tired of waiting, Drachmas, Han said.
Patience, Anna Solo. Waiting is not yet tired of you.
Han Solo turned to his wife, who was sitting at the breakfast table.
You see what I've had to put up with?
He turned back to Drachmas, who had come to pay her morning call, as she did every day. I'm still not sure why we're here. Right from the moment you yanked me out of that cell, I haven't known if I was your partner or your prisoner.
I'm afraid it's not that simple. To my people, these things, partner, prisoner, hostage, negotiator, are not so separate from each other as they are with your folk. In our tradition, one might be one of these, or all at once, or some changingly over time.
So which is it?
It is not yet determined.
Traditions make for an awfully handy set of excuses, Mara said. Every time I have ever dealt with a Salonian who didn't want to do something, she's explained to me how tradition made it impossible. No more. This isn't some trade deal for luxury goods where you can leave us hanging for 6 months on the off chance that your convenient traditions will get us so frustrated that we will give up and offer a better price. This is war.
What is the meaning of your words?
In 1 hour, I am going to walk around to the landing pad on the other side of this villa. I am going to board the Jade's fire, and I am going to fly away. The only way to prevent my departure is to have our group meet with someone in authority. My companions are welcome to join me if they wish, but I will be leaving in any event.
And I'll be with her, said Han.
Leia looked troubled, but she nodded.
And so will I.
Drachmas looked from one of them to the other.
But
you have 1 hour. Go, make things happen, Mara said. Drachmas dropped to all fours and rushed away as fast as she could. Leia was angry.
If I didn't believe in the power of a united front, I would have refused to go along with you. I'm a diplomat, and you're not.
You should have let me do the talking.
I've been letting you do the talking, Mara replied. All that's gotten us so far is an enforced vacation at this villa.
I'm a businesswoman, a trader. Negotiation is my stock in trade. I had to let them know they'd lose everything if they didn't ask for something right now. Maybe if we can figure out what's going on around here, we can make some good decisions.
There's something we need to consider. Drachmas told us that all these worlds have repulsors, and that someone from the outside was helping to organize the search for them.
We've seen all sorts of indications that the various rebellions on the Corellian worlds regard the repulsors as being hugely valuable, but I have a hunch that the repulsor searches aren't because of the revolts. My guess is that the revolts are happening as a cover for the repulsor searches.
That makes sense if it's someone from outside doing the organizing, said Leia. I can't quite see the racist thugs in the Human League approaching their close personal friends in the Salonian Overden to put this together. If I were the outside force setting up the deal, I'd say something like, cooperate with us, use your local people to dig up the repulsor for us, hand it over, and when we kick the New Republic out, we'll give you a free hand on your own planet.
Except then you run the risk of the rebels deciding that the repulsors were worth something, Han said.
At a guess, something like that is what happened with the Human League, Mara said. The externals are probably the ones running the Starbuster, not the Human League. When the Human League started tossing threats around, the external force couldn't have been too happy about it.
Sooner or later, Leia said, the interdiction field in the Chamming will be turned off. But if Thrak and Sal Solos manage to grab a few of the repulsors by then, he'll have some serious bargaining chips. Leia thought for a moment.
If all this is true, cut the links between the rebels and the external forces, gain control of the repulsors, figure out how to use them against the externals, and the rebellions ought to dry up and blow away.
Fine, Han said. Very nice and neat. I don't see how we could even start to accomplish any of those jobs.
He turned to Mara.
Do you have an idea how the Salonians fit into all this? Are the Overden and the Hanshizuk even still fighting each other?
It wouldn't surprise me if they had stopped fighting. But if they have, that's probably bad news for us. It would mean that the Overden has seized control of the repulsor. A lot of times we humans fight on, even when all hope is lost. Honor requires it, or we're hoping for a miracle, or we're praying that a million to one chance breaks our way. Not the Salonians. Typically, a fight between two groups ends when one side or the other demonstrates they have a massive advantage over the other. The Salonians, on the losing side, will ally themselves with the winners. There was a new voice at the door.
The inestimable Mara Jade has described the situation exactly.
The newcomer was an older-looking Salonian, tall but a little stooped over. Her fur shot through with gray.
I am Klaevitz, and I speak for the Overden. We have won our Hunshuzuk sisters over to our cause.
She paused, then smiled, displaying an unpleasantly impressive collection of teeth.
And that means that we have also won all of you.
3. Zubit.
Mortis. Nor chalk. Normal.
Normal processing resumes.
Reset, Wilder.
The stream of babble continued as Q9X2's head spun around and a forest of probes and sensors and manipulator arms popped in and out of their compartments. Anakin frowned.
Not quite.
The little boy pushed the droid's main power button off and reached into Q9's interior and unplugged a cable.
This one was in backwards.
He plugged the cable back in and turned the power back on. This time, the droid powered up a bit more sedately. He beeped twice and announced,
Normal processing resumes.
Well, I should hope so,
said Ebrahim.
After all that trouble we have been through in order to get you fixed.
Ebrahim left the droid with the children and returned to the Millennium Falcon. His aunt was sitting at the pilot station, using a pile of old clothes under her ample rump to boost her up high enough to see all the instruments.
Greetings, Aunt. Is there anything to report?
She shook her head.
No, there is not. And for that, let us be profoundly grateful.
Suddenly she stopped talking and looked at the overhead detector display.
It would appear I spoke too soon.
And she slapped down the red alert button.
Aunt, what is it?
It's a ship coming in right on top of us.
It's amazing how much you can find when you know where to look, said Lando, studying the data flowing over the screen.
And it doesn't hurt to have someone as good at data searches as R2. And, well, even 3PO's language skills have been helpful.
3PO turned his head briskly.
Helpful? I would say they have been essential. You wouldn't have been able to translate a tenth of that information without me.
Don't push it.
Yes, you were a great help, all right?
There, I said it. But I was about to say that without Administrator Sonson, we wouldn't have gotten anywhere at all.
Jenica Sonson smiled broadly and gave Lando a jab in the ribs. All I did was show you the log files.
But the log files had told them a lot and led them in a lot of profitable directions. It was all down there, very clear.
I've now pretty much confirmed what I suspected the second I saw those conical forms in Hollowtown. That form of six small cones around a larger one is the exact geometry you need for an old-style repulsor.
But all the inhabited planets have their own repulsors, Galinda objected. What did the builders of Corellia need this place for?
Because this isn't just a repulsor. This is a hyperspace repulsor. This station was designed to open up a tunnel through hyperspace, grab a planet, and pull it back this way. It acts as more of a tractor beam than a repulsor, really.
But why would they use a space station as a super tractor beam? Jenica asked.
Lando shook his head.
That's not the question. The question is, why did your people use the hyperspace tractor repulsor as a space station? The architects of this star system built Centerpoint, used it, finished with it, and left it alone. The structure you call Hollowtown was never intended as a place to live. It was a containment facility for the massive energies the tractor repulsor put out as it was charging up.
Are you saying that Hollowtown is just a power storage battery?
Pretty much.
We're getting a little off point here, Galinda said. Can you show us why you think Centerpoint is the Starbuster?
Well, first off, either you take my word for it, or I can show you the math to demonstrate that the form and level of power needed to pull a planet in through a hyperspace link can be converted into the power needed to induce a compression wave in the star's core. If the tractor repulsor energy is directed at the core of a star and concentrated in a burst, the burst will be sufficiently powerful to touch off a nova explosion.
We'll take your word for it, Jenica said hurriedly.
Now, looking at what's happened recently, this is the pattern I can put together. First off, Centerpoint Station suddenly reorients its spin axis drastically. Then there were a lot of unexplained power surges and unscheduled energy pulses reported in the station log. Then the first glow point flare happens. Shortly thereafter, the first induced supernova happens. Then civil war breaks out. Just after the first supernova, Centerpoint shifts its spin axis again. Then there's a different sort of power flow from the automatic recording instruments, and they start at exactly the time the jamming and the interdiction field come on. Then we get the second glowpoint flare. And then the second supernova.
Lando brought up a holographic projector and threw an image of the stars near Corellia.
The red spot at the center of the display is our position. This is the position of Centerpoint's south pole relative to the starfield before things started happening.
A blue line streaked out from the center of the display and pointed toward nothing at all.
This is the pointing after the first shift in spin orientation.
A line of red lanced out and stabbed straight through the heart of a star.
That's TD-10036 EM-1271, the first star to go nova.
Lando punched in another command, and a shaft of gold streaked out and touched another star.
Fanta Zilbra, the second star on the list. A population in the tens of thousands. I know the New Republic sent a rescue mission, but I don't know how they possibly could have gotten everyone out in time. And this is where we're pointed now.
A line of violet fire flashed out and hit another star, square and true.
This is the third star on the hit list Mara Jade got in the initial warning message. Bavo Yagan. I looked it up. One source says one planet with 8 million. Another says two planets with a total estimated system population of 12 million. Center Point is the Starbuster.
And it is getting set to blast that star and those planets and all those people to cinders and dust.
When?
Galinda asked. Lando hit another control button and a countdown clock appeared. Center Point is going to have to send a tractor repulsor hyperspace burst in exactly 123 hours, 10 minutes, and 13 seconds in order to keep to the schedule in the warning message. 12 hours and 12 minutes after that, the star's core will go.
Burning stars. Center Point, my home, is a weapon, Jenica said.
Wait a second, Luke said. There's a piece that doesn't fit. If Center Point is the Starbuster, then it's the prize. Why the fuss over the planetary repulsors? 3 reasons, Lando replied. The first is they already had it, or at least had found a way to control it. I figure there is some well-hidden control room on this station, some place we wouldn't find if we looked for 100 years. Probably there isn't anyone in it anyway. All of it automated, set to work off timers and remote control. Second reason might be plain old misdirection. If you get everyone worried about the repulsors, no one's going to have time to go looking for the Starbuster. And the third reason
has been staring us right in the face, Galinda said. Part of what makes repulsors work is that they can interfere and resonate with each other, right? Power to a small side repulsor cell can deflect the beam from the main repulsor.
Lando nodded. Exactly. In theory, you could tune all the planetary repulsors into a single network slave to Center Point. Just imagine Center Point with that much power. It would be able to strike at any point in the galaxy.
Ship dove down into the repulsor chamber, moving aggressively, but not so fast that Ebrahim, standing on the Falcon's co-pilot seat, wasn't able to see the insignia painted on the underside of its fuselage. A stylized human skull with a knife in its teeth.
Human League!
He cried out. The enemy ship dropped down to a fast assault-style landing. Burly figures in combat gear were tumbling out of the attack boat's hatches even before it had stopped bouncing on its landing legs. Suddenly, huge hands were scooping Ebrahim out of the seat, tossing him out of the way. Chewbacca scrambled into the co-pilot's chair and started powering up the defense systems.
The children are aboard!
Macha shouted.
Activate the shields!
But it was too late. The Falcon was surrounded by troops standing inside the shield perimeter. A tall, heavy-set, bearded figure stepped out of the assault boat, an unpleasant smile on his face.
Sar Solo, Ebrahim said. It's him.
That's our dad's cousin? Anakin asked.
That is his cousin. And yours, child, said Marcha. But I doubt you will gain much joy from knowing him.
Dragon Sal Solo could not have been happier. It was a gift from the gods. He strode about his new possession, admiring it, thinking of all it could do and do for him. At last he had his hands on a planetary repulsor. His eyes strayed to the Millennium Falcon. What a bonus it was. Grabbing the Falcon by itself would have been enough to pay Han Solo back for the crime of escape, but to find Han's Wookiee and his children aboard as well, what could be better? Now Thrakken could manipulate Leia Organa Solo herself. But holding the children would do no good, unless Han Solo and Leia Organa Solo knew about it. The communications jamming would have to come down. Admiral Hortel Ocelage watched on the long-range scanners as the Human League assault boat plunged down the mouth of the repulsor. It was galling to be beaten to the punch, but one had to admire the audacity of the assault boat's commander, diving his ship down the barrel of a weapon that could have reduced his craft to dust in milliseconds. But that was a fast, hard assault landing, not a slower, safer arrival at a secured base.
Almost as if the other side had been as surprised as Ocelage himself. Almost as if the Human League had been trying to do what he had been trying to do. Take advantage of an unexpected opportunity to move in on the planetary repulsor. Ocelage had the feeling that something else was going to change here. And change could usually be exploited. He turned to the ensign at his side.
My compliments to Captain Semek at the controls. Tell him the intruder will move into an orbit synchronous with the planet's rotation.
Well out of line of sight from the repulsor. Luke stepped out into the huge airlock where the Lady Luck and his X-Wing were waiting and sighed in relief. Jenica had got them here faster than he had thought possible, and with that clock counting down toward the death of Bavo Yeagan, there was no time to waste. He thought he knew what he had to do next, but he had to be sure. The others watched as Luke sat down, shut his eyes, and concentrated, extending his senses as far as possible. Leia is on Salonia, he said at last. No doubt about it, I can feel her there. My guess is that Han is with her, and probably Mara Jade as well. The three children, Chewbacca and the Falcon, are on Dral. It's hard to explain, but I get the sense, the feeling, that all of them, Leia and the kids and the people with them, are all prisoners of one sort or another.
Then we better get cracking and bust them out, Lando said briskly. You go to Leia. I'll fly Gariel and Jenica back to the Bakuran fleet, where they can inform Admiral Ocelage of what we've learned. After I've dropped them off, Lieutenant Kalenda and I will fly on to Dral and see what we can do about getting to Chewbacca and the kids.
I don't like the fact that we're leaving Centerpoint unguarded, Jenica said.
What could we do, anyway?
Lando said.
Wait for someone to land and then sneak up and kick them in the shins?
Jenica cocked her head. Point taken. Luke stood up. In that case, he said, I suggest we do what we can right now.
We have you, but we'll not keep you long, said Klaevitz, speaker for the Overden.
She sat at a table opposite Mara, Leia, and Han. Jockmas sat at Klaevitz's side, demonstrating by her presence that her clan had submitted to the victors. She did not look happy to be there.
We need merely come to certain straightforward agreements, and then all may be on their way, said Klaevitz.
We're not going to come to your agreements, Leia said wearily. The morning had lengthened into late afternoon, and they were in the sumptuous interior of the prison villa. For prison it had proved to be. The Overden had thrown a force field around the Jade's fire, and guards around the force field.
All we ask is that you are acknowledging reality. We are free. We are no longer of the New Republic. Do you not agree, friend Drachmas, that complete isolation would be the greatest of blessings?
Oh, yes, Eminent Klaevitz,
Drachmas said, clearly feeling miserable and humiliated.
My den will rejoice with me in knowing we are free of all outside influence.
I'm afraid you're no good at lying, Honored Drachmas, Han said. I've seen dead people who are more convincing.
I insist that we return to the main point, Klaevitz said. Recognize the freedom of Salonia under the guidance of the Overden, or never leave this planet alive.
You've got yourself a deal, Leia said. Klaevitz looked toward her eagerly.
Then we have persuaded you?
Absolutely. We pick the second choice, the one about not leaving alive. Go ahead and kill us all, right now. Klaevitz sighed wearily and extended her claws to drum them on the tabletop. It was hard to miss just how sharp those claws were.
I can see that we're going to be here for a while.
Boy, you get out of touch for 5 minutes and everything changes, said Lando as the Lady Luck flew clear of the Mammoth Centerpoint airlock. Where's the intruder?
What's the intruder? Jenica asked.
Biggish sort of thing. A ship, a Bakuran light cruiser. It should be hard to miss, but I can't spot it.
Have you looked in the last place you had it?
Lando smiled. I did just now, and it wasn't there.
So where is it?
At a guess, something has happened, and Admiral Ocelage has charged off bravely to do something about it, whether it needs doing or not.
I'm not sure I appreciate your tone, Lando, said Gariel.
I'm not sure I appreciate the way Ocelage takes chances.
Jaina let out a sigh. Things were very bad. The prisoners sat sad and forlorn and rather crowded in the mobile stockade, unable to do anything but watch as the Human League troopers and technicians unpacked their gear, obviously getting ready to settle in for a long stay. The mobile stockade was really nothing more than a force field generator designed to stay outside the force field itself so that those held in the field could not get at the generating machinery. The force field was transparent, however, and those inside could see the generator plain as day. This did not sit well with Anakin. The idea that he could see but could not touch the device that was holding them prisoner seemed to upset him more than the fact that he was a prisoner. The other two children tried to keep him distracted, but it was not easy. Chewbacca paced back and forth from one side of the force field containment to the other. He was forced to watch the Human League techs poking around the Millennium Falcon. Once or twice a tech would open a panel and laugh out loud at what he saw. It was difficult to restrain Chewbacca at those moments. Thrakken Sal Solo marched over from the assault boat. A Human League tech was by his side, carrying a holographic recorder.
Good afternoon to all of you, said Thrakken,
in that voice that was so close to Jaina's father's, and yet so far away.
Hello,
said Jaina, and Jason muttered a hello as well. Anakin took one look at his father's cousin and burst into tears.
Why are you here?
Jason asked, glaring at Thrakken.
What do you want?
Oh, not much at all. Not much at all. I merely need some hollows of all of us together.
Why do you want our hollows?
Aunt Marcia demanded. Thrakken smiled.
I should think that would be obvious even to a member of your species. I'm in the process of turning off the communications jamming. Then I will broadcast the hollows to demonstrate that you are my prisoners. While I doubt anyone will much care what happens to a pair of rotund drawl or a psychotic Wookiee, I expect that Han and Leia Organa Solo will be inspired to more reasonable behavior if they knew I had their children and a planetary repulsor.
Marcia, Duchess of Mastagophorus, drew herself up to her full height and glared at their jailkeeper.
You are on the verge of a most serious error. For your own safety, I urge you to reconsider this act.
You are scarcely in a position to make threats, Drawl. Save your breath.
Very well. May the consequences be on your head alone.
For the briefest of moments, the bland smile flickered off Thrakken's face, but then it was back.
Now I want the three children on this side of the stockade, closest to me. And you three aliens on the far side.
The two Drawl and Chewbacca exchanged looks. It was clear they had no real choice. They moved to the opposite side of the stockade. As the technician made adjustments to the holo recorder, the children went over to the vertical wall.
Has he really made a mistake, Aunt Marcia?
Jaina asked.
Oh, yes. Very much so, child.
What are you saying, Chewie?
Jaina asked. Chewbacca looked around to make sure no Human League trooper was close enough to watch. Then he moved as close as he could to the vertical wall and opened his hand. He had a pocket comm link. Jaina grinned up at Chewbacca.
I should have known. With all that long fur, you could hide practically anything on your body. And besides, who's going to frisk a Wookiee?
But what good does that do us?
Jason asked.
That thing doesn't have any range at all.
You're forgetting someone who is quite nearby,
Ibrahim said.
Someone who has built-in communications equipment. Someone who is probably getting most tired of waiting.
In all the commotion, Ibrahim had had time to stuff Q-9 into one of the Falcon's smuggling compartments. His instructions had been simple.
Wait at least 14 hours. Do not emerge until it is safe to do so. At that time, determine the best method for coming to our aid, and carry out that method.
Cariel Captison stood on the hangar deck of the Sentinel, next to the Lady Luck. I don't think there's any argument about what we should do, she said. We go on to Dral, and rendezvous with the intruder. After they had discovered that the intruder had mysteriously disappeared, they had docked at the Sentinel and learned that Admiral Ocelage had gone ahead to investigate an unknown assault boat landing on Dral.
Absolutely, said Lando. If someone has already found a repulsor there, that is the place to be.
Not for me, it isn't, said Jenica. Sentinel and Defender are keeping watch on Centerpoint Station, and I'm the closest thing to an expert on Centerpoint they're going to get. I stay here. Kalenda cocked her eyebrow. I'd say my place is with Admiral Ocelage. Gariel and Kalenda said their farewells to Jenica and boarded the Lady Luck. But there was something more Lando wanted to say to Jenica Sunson. In fact, she said it first. Is this the part where you tell me how you never met anyone like me, and how you want to get to know me better? Lando couldn't quite tell if she were mocking him or daring him, warning him off or urging him on. He sighed, arching an eyebrow.
There was a time, not very long ago, when I would have said those words and meant every one of them. At least while I was saying them. The problem is, I did say something very like it to another lady recently, and I did mean it. The funny thing is, for the first time in my life, I'm catching myself still meaning it. I might even mean it for a long, long time. So, I'm afraid I'm going to have to back off.
Jenica looked surprised, though not half as surprised as Lando felt. You know, that might be the classiest speech of its kind on record. I think you've got yourself a very lucky lady out there. And I don't mean the Lady Luck. She stuck out her hand to shake, and Lando took it. Take care of yourself, Lando. I must admit, I almost wish you had made a play for me. As Luke Skywalker left center point, he eased the X-Wing's throttle up to maximum thrust. The dance of the orbits had put Salonia about as close to center point in the double worlds as it ever got, but the distances were still great, and he was in a hurry. Like the others who had returned to the Sentinel with Lando, he had wondered what the absence of the intruder meant, but he had no time to worry about it. He had a duty. Bovo Yeagan and its millions of people. There was at least a hope of saving them, and if they could stop the destruction of Bovo Yeagan, it might well mark the beginning of the end for the Starbuster plot and the rebellions in the Corellian system. R2's beeps were tones of warning, and Luke checked his display screens. Oh, boy. Company. A flight of 8 light attack fighters was climbing out of orbit to meet him. It was not the sort of trouble Luke needed just now. Maybe he could scare them off without getting too involved. He eased back the throttle of the X-Wing and zeroed out his shields completely, shunting all the surplus engine and shield energy to his weapon system. Take it easy, R2. I'll have the shields back up before we're in range of their weapons. The trick would be to convince the LAF that Luke and his enhanced X-Wing fighter were unbeatable, rather than just very good. Luke reached out with the Force, extending his senses as far as he could, touching the minds of the Salonian fighter pilots. He felt at once that the pilots were nervous, unsure. If he did this right, everyone would come back from this fight alive. The X-Wing leapt toward the LAF at terrifying speed. Two of the LAF fired at him panicky shots that went wild. Luke disengaged the firing computer, shut his eyes, and aimed the X-Wing by feel through the Force. Once. Twice. 3 times he fired. 1, 2, 3 turbo laser bursts hit the LAF, catching each of them square in the ventral weapons pod. Suddenly, 3 of the LAFs could fly, but could not fight. The 3 veterans got the message right away, reversing course and heading for home. 2 of the other LAFs hesitated for a moment, then followed the others. That left 3 to deal with. They were rapidly closing to firing range. Luke throttled back enough to let him put his forward shields back on, but he didn't switch power back to weapons charging. R2, later. I've got another problem right now.
Luke switched the fire control selector from laser to torpedo and rapidly punched in a series of commands. Suddenly, all three LAF fired at once. The laser blast slammed into the X-Wing, and Luke gave thanks that he had thought to reactivate the shield when he did. He fired the reprogrammed proton torpedo square into the center of the LAF formation. Part of what Luke was counting on was the element of surprise. No one used proton torpedoes in fighter-to-fighter encounters. They were slower and less accurate, but more powerful than turbo lasers intended for use against bigger targets. The three LAF fired in volley again. The next volley would punch through his shields for sure. The proton torpedo exploded precisely in the middle of the LAF formation, lighting up the sky, no doubt blinding the pilots for a second or two, and with any luck, scrambling half their instruments as well. Luke accelerated right into the blast of the proton torpedo, hanging on for dear life as he rode the maelstrom. Then suddenly, it was over. He was clear. Luke checked his detector screens. Two of the LAFs were clearly disabled, while the third seemed to be in only marginal control. Luke knew better than to stick around to see how it all came out.
All right, R2, what is it?
R2 took control of the main status display screen and showed him the communication status.
The communications jamming is down. But why?
Then the screen cleared. A grinning, stylized human skull with a knife between its teeth appeared on the screen, the symbol of the Human League. The skull faded out to be replaced by the only somewhat more pleasant features of a smiling Thrakken Salsolo. But Luke was not smiling as he listened to what the man had to say. It was evening, and Klaevitz and Drachmas were leaving the prison villa. Han had lost count of the number of times they had come to call, asking if Leia had changed her mind yet. Suddenly, the comm system in the corner came to life. A blare of static filled the room. There was Sal Solo, seated in what looked like the control room of a small military craft.
Greetings to all of you throughout the Corellian system. I am Thrakken Sal Solo, Diktat of Corellia. I have ordered that all communications jamming be turned off so that I might inform you of two very important new prizes that Human League troops acting under my command have won. First, let it be known that we have gained control of Drahl's planetary repulsor. Soon we will control the repulsor on Corellia as well. With these powerful weapons, we shall be able to protect ourselves from all our enemies. The second prize that we have won is of a more personal nature. We have rescued the three children of Leia Organa Solo, Chief of State of the New Republic.
Han felt his heart turn to ice. He looked to Leia and saw the same horror there.
We have saved them from the aliens who held them prisoner. They are safe here with me now. I look forward to my chance to return them to their mother. First, of course, she must come out of hiding and confirm her recognition of the Corellian sector's freedom. I offer this holographic imagery to prove that I have the repulsor and have the children safe.
The screen went dark, and then showed a vast silver cylindrical space. The holocam panned to show an assault boat, and the Millennium Falcon, sitting at the bottom of the cylinder. The holoview swung back down to the floor of the chamber and zoomed in on a group of forlorn-looking figures in a force field containment. The holocam moved from face to face. Jason, looking sad but determined. Jaina, worried. Anakin glaring straight at the cam. The image faded away and returned to Thrakken.
I await the answer of the Chief of State, and as Diktat of the independent sector of Corellia, I call upon all Corellians to grant me their allegiance.
Han, we can't do what he says.
Leia looked to her husband, her eyes full of tears.
I know.
What good would it do, even if Leia said the words, even if she confirmed Corellian independence? At the very least, she would be driven from office, more than likely arrested on a charge of treason, and the agreement repudiated.
This is most horrifying, said Drachmas. Thraken turns even more deeply against his own blood, his own den and clan.
Klaevitz turned toward Drachmas.
What is it you are saying, Hunchazuk?
No, you're not, Eminent Klaevitz. Thraken Sal Solo is of the blood of Han Solo, of Leia Organa Solo's children.
Impossible.
He said things that were not true for his own gain.
Impossible again. He said that...
Quiet, both of you, Mara shouted. It is possible, and he has done it. Now, respect their shock and sorrow. Be gone.
No,
shouted Han. All his anger at his cousin suddenly found a new target, one closer to home.
Stay where you are.
You,
Klaevitz,
how dare you sneer at Thraken Sal Solo because he holds those of his blood hostage for gain?
Darkness is of your blood, and you hold her hostage, forcing her to collaborate with you in harassing us?
Honored Solo, please, no more,
Drachmas said. Han turned to Drachmas. There is much more. Your people speak the truth and have no skill in lies. Can you say with honesty that anything of what I say is wrong?
Drachmas seemed smaller, sadder.
No, I cannot.
Suddenly Han was inspired.
Then let us have more truth. You, Klaevitz. Speak now of your repulsor. Who operates it?
Klaevitz looked suspiciously at Han.
Why, good Selonians, of course.
But whose Selonians? Are they of the Overden?
There was a moment's silence. Then Klaevitz's whiskers twitched once.
I must say no more about that.
Han felt an angry jubilation. He had won, he knew it. But he could not play the next card in this hand of Sabak. Only Drachmas could turn it over.
You are wrong, Eminent Klaevitz,
Drachmas hissed.
You must say a great deal more. Who controls the repulsor? We capitulated because you had shown your power, but the power was not yours. Who?
Drachmas's eyes blazed, her claws were out, her teeth bared.
Who? It is... They are... The Castouts, the Sikorians, the Selonians of the Triad.
The Sikorians, Mara whispered. The Triad? I don't believe it.
If an outworlder, a human skilled in lies, had told me such a thing, I would join with the Honored Jade and refuse to believe it,
Drachmas said at last.
But you, as Selonian, speak the words, Klaevitz, and I am forced to believe. The truth fills me with revulsion.
Klaevitz dropped to all fours and cringed at Drachmas's feet, submitting to her and begging for mercy.
Rise up, snarled Drachmas. Rise up and come with me. Others must hear, and then the days of the Overden will be over.
Klaevitz got up on her hind legs and bowed deeply to Drachmas. Drachmas did not acknowledge the bow, but turned and left the room. Klaevitz followed, head down, shoulders slumped, the roles of victor and vanquished utterly reversed.
What happened? Han asked.
I'll explain later, Mara said. Right now, see to Leia. Leia was sobbing quietly to herself.
Oh, Han, our children. That man has our children.
I know. But he is not going to keep them. I promise you that we will...
But suddenly, Leia was on her feet, an eager, faraway look in her eyes. It's Luke. Luke is coming this way. I can feel him reaching out with the Force to me.
How? The sound of Luke's X-Wing flying past rattled the windows and knocked several knick-knacks off tables. Han rushed out the open doors and saw the X-Wing swinging around to make another pass. The X-Wing made one long circuit around the villa, firing one or two bursts of turbolaser fire to encourage the guards to be on their way. The guards took very little convincing. By the time the X-Wing sat down next to the Jade's fire, they were all headed straight for the nearest spot on the horizon.
Q-9! Q-9, come in! Q-9, are you there?
Of course I am here. I'm here, right where you left me, upside down in a storage bin. Where else would I be?
Ebrahim's whispered voice came in via the droid's comlink system.
An interesting rhetorical question. Suffice to say that the Human League troops are asleep, and we would like you to come over here now.
With pleasure. But why have they not posted a guard? Why are they so lax?
We are at the bottom of a pit, being held inside a force field, and of the two ships available, one is non-functional, and the other is full of enemy troops. I expect they feel rather secure.
Where did you get the comlink?
Q-9 asked suspiciously.
I did not know that you had one. How do I know you are Ebrahim?
Q-9, I do believe that you have developed a paranoid streak.
You would develop one, too, if your main circuits were shorted out by a maniac child, and you were barely given a chance to double-check your repairs before you were stuck in a dark hole.
A note of impatience crept into Ebrahim's voice.
Let me see if I can put your mind somewhat at ease. I myself did not learn that Chewbacca had concealed the comlink on his person until long after we were off the ship. As for the other matter, I am indeed Ebrahim. The receipt of sale shows I paid $1,250 crowns for you. However, at the last minute, I managed to talk your owners into a discount for cash of 100 crowns, a detail which I forgot when I inadvertently reported the higher amount as a deduction on my taxes. You pointed out the discrepancy to me and threatened to turn me in if I did not correct it. Does that satisfy you?
I suppose so.
Then stop acting like a victim of paranoid dementia and get the blazes over here as quickly and as quietly as you can.
Q-9 extruded a pair of manipulator arms and slowly pushed himself straight up out of the compartment. Then he floated briskly toward the force field containment. Anakin knew exactly what had to be done to get them free.
The control panels turned away from us, but I think there's a big slot for a sort of metal key right in the middle of it.
Yes, there is.
Step by step, Anakin guided Q-9 to adjust the control so that the side of the force field where the children were held was as low as it could go.
All right, here goes,
Anakin said at last. He extended his arms and spread his stubby fingers as far as they would go. He shut his eyes and stepped forward until his hands were in contact with the force field. Pushing slowly, gently, he thrust his hands deeper and deeper into the weakened force field. The field around his hands began to shimmer and spark brightly at first, but then fading away, until Anakin was standing in a pushed-out bubble of the force field.
Help me,
he said to his brother and sister. Jason and Jaina stepped cautiously forward into the extruded bubble. They pushed together, stretching the field, until the tip of Anakin's finger was outside the field. The children held hands and slowly moved out from the field. The stretched-out part of the force field shimmered and sparked one last time, and then retracted, merging into the rest of the field as if there had never been a distortion in its surface.
That was impossible, of course, said Q-9. No one can walk through a force field that way.
We didn't go through it, really, Anakin said. It was more like we stretched it out until there was room between the field, and then I just pushed the parts apart and went through. Anakin, what about Chewbacca and Ebrahim and Aunt Marcia? Asked Jaina.
Anakin shook his head.
I don't think I can do it from this side. Not to pull people through. Can you do anything with the control panel? Jaina asked. No, I can make stuff do what it's supposed to do. The lock's doing what it's supposed to do. It's already working.
Ebrahim spoke up.
If we indeed cannot get out, the children must attempt to escape on their own. With your help, of course, Q-9.
How? How are we supposed to get away?
By flying in the Millennium Falcon, of course.
The alarm buzzer squawked wildly in Tendra Rezant's ship, the gentleman caller. What had broken down this time? She checked all the displays, but saw nothing but a green board. Then she remembered. She had installed this alarm herself, the one that went off when the Navicomputer detected the interdiction field going down. The interdiction field going down. She scrambled into the pilot's seat and set to work setting the Navicomputer. She had to move fast. Whoever controlled the interdiction field might well bring it back up again at any time. She would go to center point. The last she had heard from Lando, it had seemed he was heading that way. Admiral Ocelage himself met the Lady Luck when she landed on the hangar deck of the intruder. He led the crew to his private quarters, where Lieutenant Belindi Kalenda briefed him about what they had discovered on Centerpoint.
"So if I understand you correctly," Ocelage said, "if we possessed a planetary repulsor in time to deflect the hyperspace tractor repulsor shot from Centerpoint, then that would save all the good people of Bovoyegan. And perhaps, just incidentally, win us the war. Do I have that about right?"
"Just about right, sir,"
said Lieutenant Kalenda. "However, it is more than a question of possessing the repulsor. It is knowing how to use it, and I'm not sure Thrakken Sal Solo is able to control it."
"But they fired it already."
"Not really, sir. It was an uncontrolled startup. There was a massive burst of uncontrolled repulsor radiation, that's all. The Solonian repulsor shot was much more controlled. And there's another reason. Remember, his assault boat went into the repulsor after it was fired. We're only assuming it was his techs who fired it."
"After seeing that broadcast he made, I'll tell you who I think set it off," said Lando. "The children. I think they managed to turn it on by accident. The repulsor burst attracted Thrakken's attention, the same as it did yours, and he got there first." "Oh, don't be absurd," Ocelage said. "But all this is beside the point. Sal Solo has the repulsor now, and I have an assault force preparing to go in and take it from him."
Ocelage pushed a button on his desktop comm unit.
"Yes, what is it?"
"Sir, the interdiction field is coming down, and we have received communication from Source A. He is on the..."
One moment."
Ocelage stabbed another button on the comm, cutting off the speaker. He picked up the handset and turned to the group before him.
"My apologies to you all. I gave my word to keep discussions with this source private."
While they waited for Admiral Ocelage, Lando, Kalenda, and Gariel went up to the bridge to get a better view of what was going on. What could be seen from there did not exactly make Lando happy. The tactical schematic display showed the Sentinel, the Defender, the relative positions of Talus, Trollus, and Centerpoint, and at least 50 unidentified ships, with more appearing at every moment.
"The Sicurian fleet," Lando said to Kalenda. "The Triad fleet that Tendra warned us about."
"But what are they doing here?" Kalenda demanded. "Whose side are they on?"
"I think a better question might be, who is on their side?"
Admiral Ocelage had appeared beside them.
"I expect that fleet is in search of the people who have caused them the most trouble in this system. And I'm afraid our little squadron does not meet that qualification."
"Who's caused them more trouble than we have?" Gariel demanded.
"The Human League," Kalenda answered. "The Human League hijacked their whole operation, or at least tried to."
"Exactly. The Sicurians, or at least the Triad who rule that world, they were the ones behind it all."
"The Triad?" Gariel asked.
"That is the name given to the joint dictatorship that rules Sicoria. One human, one Drow, one Solonian. No one knows anything about the three dictators, not even their names. I believe they discovered the secret of Centerpoint and recruited malcontents on the various worlds to front revolutions for them. Something they could hide behind while digging up the repulsors."
"How do you know all this?" Kalenda asked.
"I know almost none of it," Ocelage said. "I am guessing. I am also guessing that something went wrong with the plan. And the something was named Thrakken Sal Solo. Somehow or another, he inveigled his way into the inner reaches of the Starbuster plot, and he betrayed it."
"But what are you going to do about those ships?" Gariel asked Ocelage. "They've been continuing to arrive while we've been talking here. There must be 75 of them out there. Shouldn't we be getting back to Centerpoint to help out Defender and Sentinel?"
"No.
The intruder must complete her mission here before rejoining the other ships. The assault on the repulsor is still our top priority.
Han Solo paced the ground before the villa prison where he, Luke, Mara, Leia, and Drachmas had just had dinner. "Honored Drachmas, please," Han said, "explain to me why it's in our best interest to just sit here and wait."
"Very well. The three things that matter most to Salonians are honor, consensus, and the Den. The Triad Salonians on Sicoria descend from the despised offshoot of a bloodline discredited long ago. Some of them tried to lie and cheat their way into a position of advantage over other members of their own Den. They were kicked off Corellia by my ancestors, the Hunshuzok, and also removed from Salonia by the Overden. They formed a new Den, under a new name, because the old name was utterly dishonored. Even now I must not speak it."
Han said, "If I've got this straight, now that Clavitz has admitted to being in the pay of the Triad with this despised group, that changes everything, right?"
"Right. The Overden achieved a consensus favorable to themselves by trickery, and by involving themselves with a dishonored and nameless Den. Even worse, the nameless Den was linked to Triad, and Triad linked to Sal Solo, who kidnaps his own. Now, Hunshuzok will take over."
"But the Sicorian Salonians are still the ones running the repulsor," Luke objected.
"Yes, and so we must wait. We will talk with Sicorian scums, nasty though job will be. Finally, peer pressure on Sicorians to give up will be too much. They will cooperate with Hunshuzok, tell us how to run machinery as part of their penance for being on the losing side."
"How long do we have to wait?" asked Luke. Drachmas shook her head.
"An hour? A day? A month? A year?"
Luke frowned. "An hour we have, maybe even a day, but not much longer. Center Point Station is going to fire at Bovo Yeagan in just over 84 hours.
"Should I reset the breaker now?" Jason asked.
"Not yet. Just a sec," said Anakin. "One more to stick in."
He was lying on his stomach, leaning over the open underfloor access panel. He stared down into the morass of wires and cables and circuit boards, then made some adjustments.
"All right. Push the reset."
There was the slightest of pauses, and then the green status light came on. Jason breathed a sigh of relief, then turned to Q9.
"It worked, Chewbacca. We ought to have repulsors and sublight engines now."
There was something more than a bit incongruous about Chewbacca's voice coming from Q9's speaker.
"We have to hurry,"
Q9 translated. Jason got to his feet.
Okay, we're hurrying."
Jason paused at the entrance to the cockpit of the Millennium Falcon. He had been up here many times before, of course, but this was different. No one was keeping an eye on him this time, or making sure he didn't press any buttons, or shooing him away. No, this time he was here to fly the ship. The very idea terrified him. He took his place at the pilot station, adjusting the seat as high and as far forward as it would go.
"All right, Chewie, we're switching over to the ship's main comm system now."
He reached over to the comm panel and threw the appropriate switch.
"That's a relief," said Q9.
Jason glanced behind him and made sure that Anakin, seated in the observer seat behind Jaina, had his belt on. Q9 had clamped himself to a stanchion.
"Everyone set?"
"Not quite,"
said Jaina.
"Those humanly guys are going to come after us the moment we take off. Maybe we should sort of slow down good old cousin Thrakken a little bit."
"Wait a second," protested Jason. But Jaina had already activated the fire controls for the Falcon's ventral laser cannon.
"I figure one shot at the force field generator, then I re-aim and take a crack at the assault boat."
"The force field generator," Jason said. "Suppose you miss and hit Chewie and the Drolls.
I can't hit them. They're behind the force field, remember? You just be ready to get us moving straight up the repulsors the second I tell you to.
Jason shook his head doubtfully.
All right. But remember whose idea it was to start shooting.
Jaina stared down at the gunnery display, making minute adjustments to the ventral laser's aim.
Here we go. One, two, three.
A blast of fire roared from the ventral laser cannon, catching the force field generator square in the center of the control panel. The force field winked out of existence. Jaina swung the laser cannon around in the general direction of the assault boat and fired again. The shot missed the boat, completely blasted light bouncing off the reflective walls of the chamber to ricochet around a dozen times before it dissipated. She fired again and scored a glancing hit. Jason could see Chewbacca and the two Drawl running for the nearest entrance to the side caverns.
Jaina, the way those shots are ricocheting, you're more likely to hit Chewie than Thraken. You're right. Let's get out of here. Everyone hang on. I've never done this before.
He pulled back on the repulsor power control, and the Millennium Falcon lumbered up into the sky.
Behind us, Anakin shouted. Look at the detector screen.
There was Thraken's assault boat hot on their heels. A blast of laser flared past the Falcon's starboard side, and Jason heeled the ship up, flipping her over. The Falcon was suddenly climbing at a 45-degree angle of attack, but with the cockpit pointed down instead of up. The accidental maneuver seemed to have shaken Thraken off their tail, at least for the moment, but he would be back, and he'd start shooting at them again.
Shields up! Jason shouted. Where are the shield controls? Jaina asked. Chewie moved them when he rewired the cockpit, Anakin said from the observer seat. Under your left hand, sort of, the panel with the big red buttons. Where? I don't see it. I'll get it.
Anakin undid his seat restraint, hopped out of his seat, and wriggled in between the two pilot stations. He reached in and flicked the safeties off a row of red switches, pressed down on a big red button, and twisted two dials.
All right, now shields up.
The shudder that ran through the ship told Jason that Anakin had gotten the shields up just in time, and that Cousin Thraken's aim was getting better.
Shoot!
Thraken shouted.
Shoot! Blast your eyes!
The boat's captain, a fat, bald man named Thrag, was used to taking orders from Thraken, but he was not afraid of him. He protested.
But they're your own blood relatives!
I'd shoot at them myself. I'm not hypocrite enough to pretend there's a difference.
Thrag turned his attention from his flying and looked Thraken up and down.
Do your own dirty work, then, and welcome to it!
And Thrag switched over gunnery control. Ossilage's ensign rushed into the flag deck of the intruder.
Sir, two ships just came out of the repulsor, one in pursuit of the other.
Ossilage stabbed a button on the flag deck's main console, and the commander of his assault troops responded.
Putney's here.
Commander Putney, this is Ossilage. It looks like everyone has cleared out of the repulsor. I want your troops headed toward an assault speed landing in the repulsor immediately.
Ossilage turned toward Kalenda.
Get me visual and tactical on the two ships now.
Kalenda worked the controls with lightning speed. The images of two ships appeared on the long-range visual scanner. Both were clawing for altitude, the one in the lead flying erratically and upside down.
That's the Falcon, Lando said.
Who's flying her? Kalenda asked.
I have an idea, but none of you would believe me.
Ossilage looked at him sharply. You're saying one of the children is flying that ship?
You said it. I didn't. Wait until they're both in range, and then get tractor beams on both of them. Pull the Falcon in, but just hold the assault boat where it is, at least for the moment.
The Falcon lurched wildly to one side as the assault boat managed another hit. Anakin watched the defense display.
Shields didn't like that one. That's it, said Jaina. I've had it. Let's give them some of their own back. Powering up ventral laser cannon and setting for aft aim.
What? Jason cried. Are you out of your mind?
I think you're all out of your minds,
Q9 said.
Ventral laser on auto-target seek. I've got a target lock.
Jaina squeezed the trigger and the laser cannon blazed away.
Hit him! Shields absorbed the shot, but I made him back off a little.
Jason risked a peek at the detector screen.
Jaina, he's not backing off. He's bringing his main turret cannon to bear. We've got to get out of here.
Jason pulled the nose of the Falcon up, right on Thrakken's tail.
Anakin! Forward shields to full!
Anakin scrambled to reset the switches. Just in time to deflect a near miss from the assault boat's turret gun. The Falcon bucked and shuddered, but her shields held.
We're in behind their shield! I have a shot! Hang on!
Jaina called.
She fired.
The shot caught the turret gun, blowing it clean off the hull. She fired again, smashing the sublight emitters down to nothing. The assault boat was dead in space. Jason had to stop cheering long enough to keep from ramming the Falcon right into her stern. And then, a giant invisible hand reached out and yanked the Millennium Falcon by the scruff of the neck. Han, Leia, and Mara were still waiting. Drachmas was still telling them to be patient. It seemed as if nothing was ever going to happen. And then a noise came from Mara's pocket. At exactly the same moment, R2 started spinning his view dome back and forth. Mara shoved her hand in the pocket of her coveralls and pulled out a comlink. I forgot I had this thing. That's a call from the ship's monitoring systems. A high-priority message just came in.
R2?
Asked Luke. Are you getting it, too? R2 let off an affirmative-sounding trill. Gotta be the same one. I've got to go over to the Jade's Fire to read my copy. Anyone care to tag along and see what it is? At the ship's command station, Mara hit the play button, and a hologram of Lando shimmered into view.
Hello. I don't know exactly what your situation is, so I will send copies of this to all of you. A lot has happened. The bad news is that the real enemy has finally shown up. It's the fleet from the Sikorian Triad.
Lando broke into a broad smile.
The good news is very good indeed. The children have escaped from Thrakken, and they did it aboard the Millennium Falcon. They flew the ship, and before you turn blue, Han, the Falcon doesn't have so much as a scratch on her. But the punchline is they captured Thrakken. Han, you should have seen it. The kids flew a classic inside loop and put two disabling shots right into Thrakken's stern. The Bakurans have taken Thrakken prisoner. The kids are safe and sound aboard the intruder. Chewbacca and two Drow who got mixed up in all this are being picked up from the repulsor right now. My third reason for sending you this message is to ask you to come here. Gariel Captison has called a council of war for 18 hours from now. We need you all present.
Leia Organa Solo, chief of state of the New Republic, ran full tilt down the access ramp of the Jade's Fire onto the hangar deck of the intruder and nearly knocked over two of the honor guard as she rushed to her children. Han was hard on her heels, and Luke soon joined the happy little knot of chaos. Admiral Ocelage allowed himself a wintry smile as he stood by Gariel Captison, watching the proceedings.
Not the most dignified of entrances, eh, Madam Prime Minister?
Gariel thought of her own little daughter, Malinza, back home on Bakura. She watched Luke Skywalker lifting his niece up onto his shoulders and thought of how good he was with children, and of all the things that might have been between the two of them, but never could be now.
I think it's beautiful.
Admiral Hortel Ocelage regarded her with frank surprise.
Indeed. Clearly, then, standards of beauty vary greatly. Mine do not include noisy and unruly children.
Then, I pity you. I know of nothing else that brings more beauty into my life.
Gariel stepped forward, leaving a stunned Admiral Ocelage in her wake. Let the old sourpuss chew on that for a while, she told herself.
Belindi Kalenda addressed the Council of War, gathered on the flag deck of the intruder.
To cover the simple side of this situation first, the enemy is closing in on Centerpoint. They need to keep us from interfering with the next Tarbuster burst. Considering the number of lives at stake, I do not think anyone will disagree with me when I suggest that the destruction of our entire force would indeed be a low enough price for victory. And we must face the fact that we run such a risk. We have 3 major combatant ships, carrying a total of 32 flight-worthy fighters. The enemy has at least 80 larger spacecraft. If all of them carried a full complement of fighters, though I very much doubt they do, the number of fighters on their side would be well up in the hundreds. The complicated side of the situation is that we almost but not quite control 2 of the repulsors, the one on Drow and the one on Salonia. Unless, said Mara, the Triads people are sitting on the Talusian and Tralusian and Corellian repulsors just waiting for the signals to push the button. Exactly right, said Kalinda. If the enemy controls those, he has the ability to crush our ships to rubble.
But we don't think they have that capability, Ocelage said. Their fleet is moving in with a great deal of caution.
That caution might also explain why they haven't reactivated the interdiction field, said Mara. They might want to be sure they have a way out of here. That's possible, said Jenica Sonson. But we don't think they can reactivate it while Centerpoint is at this stage of powering itself up for a Starbuster shot. Too much power being diverted, too many systems busy. At least we think that's the case.
It better be the case, said Ocelage. Our plans with Source A depend on it.
Excuse, please, said Drachmas. What or who is Source A?
We'll come to that a bit later, Ocelage said.
What about Centerpoint itself, Han asked. Is there any weak spot we know about, some place where we might pile in a lot of firepower and get lucky, blow the place up?
I know, sorry, said Sonson. It doesn't work that way. Don't forget that the Glow Point is a containment vessel for an extremely powerful reaction. It's very strong, and it's very good at absorbing and dispersing energy. The figures we worked up show that the energy levels in there at the moment are the equivalent of setting off a proton torpedo at least once a second. And Centerpoint has been putting up with that for days on end. The rest of the structure is very strong and very old and so well sealed and shielded that we've never been able to map most of the interior. I'm told the Sentinel has landed search parties that are doing their best to find the control system and shut the system down. But that control system has kept itself pretty well hidden for at least 1,000 generations. I doubt they'll find it in just a day or two of looking.
Let's talk about the repulsors for a minute, said Luke. Where are we with them? How about the Salonian repulsor, Drachmas? The Salonian shook her head mournfully.
There is no changing. The Sikorian Salonians, the Triad Salonians of the Nameless Den, are weakening. They see the force of our arguments. We have tried everything, but they are not with us yet.
Have you tried Kash? Mara asked.
I am begging your pardon.
Cash. Money. A travel case full of credit notes. You know, a bribe. Or make it sound nice, call it a consulting fee. Tell them you want to hire them. Drachmas looked amazed.
This had never been occurring to us. We will try it at once.
Good. And don't be cheap about it.
What about our repulsor?
Asked the drawl Ebrahim.
Have you made any progress with it?
Ocelage responded,
Our tech staff has only had a few hours to work on it. It's early to expect results, but rest assured we have every person with pertinent experience down there working right now.
That is not the case,
said a stern female voice.
It was the other drawl, Marcha, the Duchess of Mastigophorus.
It is not the case, Admiral, and you know it.
Duchess, might I ask what you are talking about?
The children. Anakin in particular, but he works best when the other two are there to guide him.
Don't be absurd. How could they possibly have any expertise? I would urge you not to mistake a series of lucky accidents for ability. Continue with the briefing, Lieutenant.
Kalenda hesitated a moment. It was not her place to contradict her superior officer, but on the other hand, it was not his place to be a pig-headed fool.
Sir, my apologies for discussing this in front of others, but the stakes are too high. I believe you are making a mistake.
What?
Sir, it is my job to analyze events and come to conclusions. The plain fact of the matter is that you have a repulsor down there because a 7.5-year-old boy found it for you and turned it on. It is no longer in the hands of our enemy, and our enemy is in the brig because that boy and his siblings managed to walk through a working force field, repair a disabled starship, fly that ship into space, and shoot down a pursuing spacecraft flown by a professional military pilot.
Osselage looked up at Kalenda.
You argue most effectively, Lieutenant Kalenda. You will either go far as an intelligence officer, or end your career in the brig for insubordination. Madam Chief of State, Captain Solo, if, as Lieutenant Kalenda claims, your children might be of help, would you consent to their being put to work?
We need all the help we can get, said Leia. Let them do their part.
After the war council broke up, there were plenty of goodbyes. The children went back to Dral with Drachmas, Ibrahim, and Q-9 to work on the repulsor. Everyone else prepared for battle. They all knew the odds were against everyone making it back. But one leave-taking had a different set of emotions behind it. Thraken was sitting on a low bench set against the far wall of the brig.
Hello, Thraken. Han said.
Hello, Han. Come to see the rare specimen in his cage?
I'm not sure why I came. For some reason, I wanted to see you.
Thraken threw his arms out wide and stuck his chest out.
And here I am. Get a good look.
The children. My children. You should not have kidnapped the children. Never involve the innocent. Always protect your family. Two of the oldest traditions of Corellia. How could you break those laws?
Thraken sighed wearily.
Han, please. There's not much point in teaching me right from wrong, not at this late date.
You're beaten, Thraken.
Thraken chuckled.
True enough, but I do have one consolation.
What's that? Thraken Salsola would be diktat of Corellia, gestured vaguely toward the outside of the cell, toward the universe beyond.
The Triad fleet out there. Maybe I've lost, Han. But it does me a world of good to know that you haven't won yet. And I don't think you're going to, either.
At last it was time to board ship, launch, and head out into space. Once clear of the intruder, Han eased back on the sublight engines and waited for the others to form up behind him. They were going into battle together. Han, Chewie, and Leia aboard the Millennium Falcon, Mara Jade alone aboard the Jade's Fire, Lando aboard the Lady Luck, and Luke in his X-Wing. Han watched as the Lady Luck flew out of the hangar doors and toward him.
Suddenly, he felt good.
They were flying into danger, into battle, but what of that? He had done it before. He was behind the controls of his own ship, in space, surrounded by friends. He saw the Lady Luck do a double barrel roll just as Luke's X-Wing launched. Han laughed out loud. He wasn't the only one feeling good. He keyed on the comm system.
Falcon to Lady Luck. Lando, you old pirate, the idea is to fly in a straight line just at the moment. I think you just wobbled off course a bit.
Can't a guy have a little fun now and then?
How far have you gotten?
Asked Anakin, as he looked over the gleaming silver control panel. The technician's name was Antone, a thin fellow, dark-skinned, with shoulder-length shiny black hair. He didn't answer at first, but instead gave Anakin a strange look, a look Anakin had seen before. It was the look he got from grown-ups who had heard he was weirdly good with machines, but didn't quite believe it yet.
I'd say we're stuck. The system won't respond to any commands we give it.
Sure it will,
Anakin sat down at the control panel and pushed his hand down onto a flat, featureless spot on the console. The surface of the console started to shift, forming a joystick perfectly shaped to his hand. A hollow wireframe of cubes appeared in the air over the control panel.
"How did you do that?"
Antone demanded. He scooted Anakin out of the chair and pressed his own hand down on the same place on the panel. Nothing happened.
"Burning stars! It must have imprinted itself on your personal characteristics the first time you used it."
"Wait a moment," Ebrahim objected. "Are you saying what I think you're saying?"
Antone nodded solemnly.
"Your little friend here is the only person who is going to be able to operate this control panel."
Cariel Captison watched Admiral Ocelage pace the floor of the flag deck and could not help but feel sympathy for the man. They were, for the moment, alone on the flag deck, and that fact spoke volumes. He had told everyone to go off and do his bidding, and now they were gone. Later, perhaps, this place would be chaos, with aides rushing in and out, mountains of message forms covering every flat surface, klaxons blaring, and orders bellowing out from the overhead speakers. But now, it was quiet. The overhead speaker came on.
"All outbound craft launch and clear. Intruder getting underway in 30 seconds. All hands to assigned battle stations."
Ocelage sat motionless throughout the announcement. Cariel could not tell whether he was listening intently or lost in his own thoughts. The chime sounded again. There was a change in the vibrations of the ship, and the flag deck instruments started reporting forward movement. They were on their way. Ocelage spoke after a long silence.
"Tell me, the plan. Do you think it will work?"
The irony was almost too obvious. After endless weeks of being trapped aboard the gentleman caller, wishing above all else to move faster, Tendra Rezant now had not the slightest desire for her ship to go anywhere at all. The gent floated quietly in the darkness of space in a stable orbit around Corel, an orbit that put her squarely between the Triad fleet and the two Bakurin destroyers. She had no doubt that both sides were tracking her. She did not dare maneuver for fear of one side or the other deciding she was a booby trap, a bomb, or a weapon disguised as a civilian ship. No one knew exactly what was going to happen next. But whatever it was, Tendra was going to have a ringside seat. Lando Calrissian punched up his detector system and tried to get an idea of how the Triad fleet was reacting. So far, they didn't seem to be in the least bit distracted by the intruder. The whole fleet was still moving in toward center point at a slow, steady pace. Wait a second. Lando frowned at his display. Where could that ship have come from? How could anybody get here before the Triad unless... Lando sat bolt upright. He punched the transmit button.
"Lady luck to intruder. I've just spotted something. I'm heading over to investigate it. I'll be back with the fleet in good time for the main event."
To Ebrahim's eye, the control room of Drawl's planetary repulsor looked as if a bomb had hit it. It was knee-deep in crumpled bits of paper and discarded food containers. Jaina and Jason were asleep on cots. Ebrahim and Marcha were still in the thick of it, helping the techs order their readings. Anakin was in the center of it all, going strong, working the controls as he was asked, helping the grown-ups understand what all the buttons meant.
Drachmas rushed into the room.
"Newses! I have good newses! The Sakurian Salonians! What a splendid idea this bribing was! Must congratulate Honored Jade on fine suggestion!"
"They've agreed to cooperate?"
Ebrahim asked eagerly.
"No, Arnold Ebrahim. Bribe suggestion gives them idea."
Drachmas held up a data pad and waved it in the air.
"They still not willing to help with their repulsor, but they willing to sell instruction manual."
A large booming noise echoed through the hull of Tendra Rezant's ship, the gentleman caller. Had a meteor crashed into the ship? Had something in the engine room blown up? Then Tendra heard the whirring noise of doors sliding open and air pumps working.
The airlock. Someone had docked with her ship.
She stepped out into the corridor and froze in her tracks.
There he was, right in front of her, grinning from ear to ear.
I tried to call ahead, but there wasn't any answer.
All right, Chewie, said Han. Jump off in 5 minutes. Let's look sharp. Leia, time for you to get up to the turret.
Leia stood up from the observer's seat on the Millennium Falcon.
I know,
she said. But she didn't leave. First, she stepped forward, pulled Han's head toward hers, and gave him a kiss.
I love you.
I know, and you know I love you. Leia reached over and ruffled the fur on top of Chewbacca's head.
Song, Chewie.
See you on the other side. Han watched her go, then looked over to Chewbacca.
You know, Chewie, there's a lot to be said for this being married business.
Luke Skywalker sat in the cockpit of his X-Wing and felt the old tingle of fear and excitement starting to build. It was time to fight. He was ready. His Jedi abilities made him more ready. He glanced at his chronometer. 3 minutes. Belindi Kalenda was already on the flag deck along with the rest of the flag staff, but Gariel Captison just got there in time to strap herself in.
I was in my cabin, she said, though Ocelage hadn't asked, meditating and thinking about my daughter, Malinza, who has already lost her father. Is this the day she loses her mother as well, she thought.
A good time for it, Ocelage said. There will not be much leisure for thought, starting in another 30 seconds.
10 seconds. All hands prepare for the jump to light speed. 5 seconds. 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
And the stars lanced out into spikes of fire.
Now there were more than stars in the sky. Ships of all sizes and descriptions had suddenly popped into existence. The Bacurian ships had made precision hyperspace jumps straight into the thick of the enemy fleet.
The intruder's main laser cannon opened up at once, stabbing out at a ramshackle old troop transport that had no business in the middle of a combat fleet. The transport exploded in a bloom of fire. But by then, the main lasers had found another target, an old, tough-looking ex-Imperial destroyer. The intruder opened up on her. The destroyer's forward battery blew up, and the intruder instantly redirected fire to her rear battery. The shields gave way after.
It's going well,
Ocelage announced to no one in particular. At least, thought Gariel, it's starting well.
Hang on, R2!
Luke cried out as he flipped his X-Wing over onto its back and then pulled its nose up, pursuing the X-Tie Ugly that was making a run on the Lady Luck. Lando, brake starboard and down hard on my mark. 3, 2, 1, mark! Luke broke the X-Wing down and to starboard a fraction of a second before the Lady Luck. The X-Tie Ugly, a monstrosity of a ship slapped together out of the combined wreckage of an X-Wing and a TIE fighter, was nowhere as maneuverable as an X-Wing. The Ugly fell into the trap, making a longer, shallower dive in pursuit of the Lady Luck, and setting itself up for a perfect shot from Luke. He fired, and the wing blew clean off the Ugly, sending it tumbling out of control and out of the fight. For the moment, their little patch of sky was clear. That meant it was time to move elsewhere. Lando, I'm tracking a slow-moving destroyer toward the rear of the formation. You have it?
Let's go for it. Just what we're looking for.
The plan was for the attacking craft to move through the triad formation toward its rear, picking off targets and trying to get the triad ships to reverse course and pursue.
Off we go, Luke agreed.
Anakin sat in the control chair, listening intently to Technician Antone as he ran down the checklist.
All right, that clears out the targeting sequence. We should be locked onto the south pole of center point. Ready for the power initiation sequence?
Don't think so,
Anakin said doubtfully.
Something doesn't feel right.
Antone looked nervously at him.
Feel right?
He does it all by feel, Jason said.
You've got an instruction manual. You're the one who said you didn't think he understood what it did. Anakin glared at his brother.
Do so.
Jaina was plainly getting as fed up as Antone. Do you, Anakin? Do you really understand? Or are you just showing off? Anakin crossed his arms.
Stop being mean to me, or I won't help you anymore.
And with that, he hopped down off the chair and stalked away.
I suspect that young Master Anakin is overtired,
3PO said.
He was up too late last night. He's often rather cranky the next day on such occasions.
Antone's jaw dropped open.
The Starbuster is going to fire in an hour, and you tell me he's cranky?
Take it easy, Ebrahim said.
But he's gone, and he's the only one who can run the machine.
Concentrate volley fire on the forward airlock hatch.
Mara's voice called over the Millennium Falcon's comm.
Those welds look nice and sloppy.
Turbo laser shots poured from the Jade's fire into the bulky old Mon Calamari frigate that had ended up fighting for the other side. In the quad laser turret, Leia started shooting, and the frigate fired back straight into the Falcon. The shield alarms went on almost at once, and then cut off just as quickly. As the Jade's fire blew the frigate's main laser turret clean off.
Let her go, Han said to Mara. She's out of the fight.
Then he saw something else and called to Leia.
Watch out! A pair of B-wing uglies coming in from above.
I'm on them.
An explosion broke up one B-wing, and the other decided that discretion was the better part of valor. If only the Falcon could have the luxury of reaching that conclusion, Leia thought. Sooner or later, one of those attacks was going to get through. On the intruder flag deck, Kalinda reported to Admiral Ocelage. Defender reports damage to main armament, but secondary weapons fully functional. Sentinel has partial loss of propulsion. Ocelage studied his tactical display. It was working, he thought. The tidy enemy formations were unraveling, and half of them had reversed course to head off in pursuit of their tormentors.
Sir, Captain Zemek reports four frigates closing on intruder. It appears to be a coordinated attack.
Four identical bulbous-nosed frigates were closing in from four different directions, lasers blazing, as the ships adjusted course to stay with the intruder, matching her move for move. Ocelage frowned. Something was wrong. The frigates were pouring laser fire into the intruder, but it was having no effect. There should have been local burn-throughs. The shield should have been weakened here and there. He brought up a close-up view of the nearest frigate on his tactical display, and his blood ran cold. Its windows were painted on over what looked like solid durasteel. He slapped down his comlink.
Captain Semek, those frigates are camouflaged robot ram ships. Their guns are harmless. They are merely trying to get in close enough to...
But it was too late. The first ram ship fired its high-boost engine and accelerated at terrifying speed directly at the intruder. A multi-megaton battering ram headed straight at them. Holding Anakin by the hand, Jason came back to the group gathered around the repulsor control.
Okay,
said Jason.
I have him back.
While Jason had gone to talk to Anakin, Ebrahim tried to persuade everyone else not to lose patience with the little boy. Good, said Antone. Then let's start the power initiation sequence.
No.
The sweat was standing out on Antone's forehead.
Anakin, please. Try to understand, this isn't a game. Lots and lots of people are going to die unless we fire this repulsor at exactly the right time, in exactly the right direction. I know that, but it isn't aimed just right. It's too heavy somehow.
Gravity, Jason shouted.
He means gravity. Those instructions you got are for the repulsor on Salonia. The gravity is different there.
Antone thought for a minute, muttering frantically.
He's right.
He checked the countdown clock.
And we've got 10 minutes to recalculate the aim from scratch.
And with that, Antone raced away to find a desk and a data pad. The second and the third robot ram ship slammed into the intruder, sending the ruined hulk pinwheeling across the sky.
Abandon ship. All hands abandon ship. I can't feel my legs, Gariel said. I can see they're bleeding, but I can't feel them.
Ocelage nodded. Spinal damage, he thought. He realized that he was holding his hand over his stomach. He lifted it away and saw the red, open wound. Ocelage looked from himself to Gariel Captison, to Kalenda.
Go!
He shouted at Kalenda.
We can't make it. You can. Go!
But, Kalenda began.
I have a gut wound and the Prime Minister cannot walk. Go, now. That is an order. You have been a good officer, Lieutenant Kalenda. Do not waste yourself now over a pointless gesture. Go!
Kalenda looked as if she were about to say something more, but then she stopped. She saluted Ocelage, bowed to Gario, and then turned and ran.
We have to blow the ship,
Gario said.
Don't let her be captured.
Yes, you are right, but we must wait. Give the survivors time to escape. Wait until we are in deep among the enemy ships. Take them with us. Wait. Wait for Source A. We have to wait for Admiral Akbar.
One hour, Luke,
Lando shouted.
Let's get out of here while we're still in one piece.
Copy that. Back the way we came, and fast.
What's going on? Tendra asked.
Why are we retreating?
Lando heeled the Lady Luck around.
We're not retreating. We're following Ocelage's plan. Get in, do as much damage as you can for 1 hour, and then get out of the way.
Get out of the way for what?
For Source A, my dear Source T.
What are you talking about?
Lando laughed. It's not much of a code name system. Source T for Tendra, Source A for Admiral Akbar.
Ocelage started getting coded hyperwave messages from him the minute the jamming field went down.
When does he show up?
Lando checked the ship's navicomputer and the chronometer.
Right here and right now.
The empty space in front of them was suddenly ablaze with the flaring light of starships coming in out of hyperspace. The ship screamed past the Lady Luck to either side, over her, under her, so close that they could almost hear the winds of space rushing past them. And then they were gone. Gariel Captison was starting to feel the pain, not in her legs, but everywhere else. Admiral Ocelage sat beside her, barely conscious himself, bleeding badly. In spite of everything, Ocelage had managed to open up the control panel set into the side of his chair. The ship's self-destruct. He had flicked up all the safeties and pushed down all the buttons, all but the last.
There,
he said.
There. Ship's coming in. They're here.
It's time, then,
said Gariel.
You're a good man, Admiral Ocelage. You did your duty. You held them. You stopped them. Well done.
Thank you, ma'am. I was proud to serve with you.
And I with you. But now it's time to go.
Gero thought of her daughter, Malinza, left all alone in the universe. She would be cared for. Of that Gero had no fear.
I can't move my arm,
said Ocelage.
I can't push the button.
Gariel looked up and saw that at least 3 Triad ships were near. She smiled and reached over.
Here, let me.
The explosion lit the sky, tore a hole across the Triad fleet.
Oh! Said Tendra. That was the intruder. They're gone. It's over.
Lando looked down at the ship chronometer, then at Centerpoint Station, and then toward the distant dot of light that was Drow.
No, it isn't. But in 1 minute and 20 seconds, it will be. Maybe for a lot of people.
Anton!
Jaina shouted.
Now! Now! We have to do it now!
Technician Antone came rushing back in.
I can't.
He held up the data pad.
It's still running. The last part of the problem is still running. It won't be done for another 5 minutes, at least. 12 million people. 12 million people.
Anton sat down on the floor and covered his head with his hands. Jason Solo stood riveted to the spot, his eyes wide. They had one chance to make this work.
Wait a second. Who needs numbers?
He turned toward his brother, still seated at the console.
Anakin, it felt too heavy, right? Can you fix it? Can you close your eyes and feel it? Make it feel right?
Anakin looked at his brother and his sister, swallowed hard, then shut his eyes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Eyes still closed, he held out his hands for controls that weren't there, controls that took form under his hands even as he reached for them. Glowing grids of orange and purple and green appeared and flared up and vanished around his head, but Anakin did not see them. Deep beneath their feet, a vibration began to build. They heard the crash of thunder from the repulsor, the sound of power being gathered. The joystick materialized. Anakin pushed it slowly forward, and a cube of orange appeared before his still closed eyes. He made tiny, imperceptible adjustments, and then he pulled the joystick down as hard as he could. The chamber shuddered with power, and a stream of lightning blazed down the corridor and out into the chamber. They could not see it in the control chamber, except for Anakin, who saw everything perfectly from behind closed eyes. But those on the surface and those in space could see the repulsor beam leap across space, land square on the south end of Centerpoint, just as every countdown clock reached zero, just at the moment Centerpoint was to fire. The South Pole lit up with the energy that was supposed to stream out invisible, undetected into hyperspace and murder a star. But the repulsor beam broke up the opening into hyperspace, defocused the beam, detuned it enough that part of its energy was converted into visible light. The south pole of Centerpoint began to glow. The glow spread into a magnificent bubble of harmless light that lit the skies of all the Corellian worlds, shining, blooming, growing, and then guttering down to nothing. Lando Calrissian watched it all from the deck of the gentleman caller and started breathing again.
Now, he said to Tendra. Now, it's over.
I don't even know why you were so eager to have my fleet come here,
said Admiral Ackbar in his gravelly voice. He turned and regarded Luke Skywalker through his fish-like eyes. They were on Drow, as Ackbar had been curious to inspect the repulsor.
There was hardly any work left for my ships to do, thanks to Admiral Osage and Geriel Capterson.
Thanks to them, yes, sir, said Luke. Luke thought of Geriel, of her daughter Malinza. Luke had promised Malinza he would take care of her mother. How was that debt to be paid? He thought of Osage, of the difficult, impossible man who also had a knack for doing the difficult, the impossible. I will mourn them both for a long time to come, he said. But we have won, thanks to them and many others, and thanks to those three children over there.
Anakin and Jason and Jaina were racing around climbing the hummocks of dirt that the repulsor had forced up when it shoved its way out of the ground. They were being chased by a laughing Jenica Sonson and Belindi Kalenda, who was too busy making ferocious faces to laugh. Han and Leia chuckled as their children turned the tables and started chasing Sonson and Kalenda. Mara watched the fun, and even Chewbacca was enjoying the show. Not far off, Ebrahim and the Duchess Marcha were intent in conversation. Leia had told Luke of her plan to appoint Marcha the new Governor-General of the Sector.
Drachmas sat by the two Drow,
apparently so enthralled with their conversation that she had fallen sound asleep.
You're right, of course, Admiral Ackbar answered Luke. But no one wins a war. There are just different degrees of losing.
Luke nodded. But at least some of the loose ends were being tied up already.
Admiral Akbar brought news of the arrest of one Farnes Gleesri, self-styled agent of the Human League, part of the spy ring that had sliced its way into far too many government files back on Coruscant. The entire Human League spy ring back in Coruscant had been thrown in jail, where they belonged. There was, of course, the question of what to do about the next star on the Starbuster list. And then there was the whole question of studying Centerpoint and the repulsors on the other three worlds. Who had built the Corellian system, and when, and why, and what had happened to them? Some ends were looser than others.
"You know," said Admiral Akbar, "you said it was the people here who won this war. I can't help noticing two rather prominent people who seem to be missing. Where in the world have they gone to?"
Luke smiled. "I wouldn't worry too much, Admiral. They're both pretty good at taking care of themselves."
"Lando?" said Tendra Rezont as they wandered about on the churned-up land that the repulsor had produced. It was not the loveliest of landscapes, but it did have the advantage of providing a good deal of privacy behind every hummock and furrow. "Remember how I told you that a Sikorian woman is not allowed to marry without her father's consent, no matter how old she is?"
"Yes."
Lando managed to keep his voice steady.
"What about it?"
"Well, we don't have to do anything about it immediately, but there's something more I want to tell you about that law. An interesting legal technicality. It's been well established by many precedents that a Sikorian woman is not bound by that law if she is outside the Sikorian system. If she were on Drow, for example."
"Is that so?"
Lando quickly regained his old equilibrium. The idea needed time, but he definitely liked it at first glance. He smiled and looked at her lovely face.
"Is that a certifiable fact?"
She smiled back at him. "It is."
"Then why don't we get back to the Lady Luck and discuss the whole matter over dinner? I've always found legal technicalities to be downright fascinating."
This is Anthony Heald. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Showdown at Centerpoint by Roger McBride Allen. This program was produced by David Rapkin and directed by Lars Hoel. Abridgment by Trebby Johnson. Showdown at Centerpoint is a production of Lucasfilm Limited, copyright 1995, all rights reserved. The book Star Wars Showdown at Centerpoint, Volume 3 of the Corellian Trilogy, is available wherever Bantam books are sold.